Tonight on The Download, Chicago Cubs owner Tom Ricketts, author and former Esquire editor-in-chief Lee Eisenberg, and Food and Wine Best New Chef Elizabeth's Elena Regan. And now here's your host, a man who in honor of opening day is wearing his Glen Allen Hill jersey, Justin Kaufman.
It was between that or my Mickey Morandini jersey. I just, so hard to tell. I think I'm going to get a Damon Berryhill. That would be good, wouldn't it? I think we have a new segment. Which jersey, which Cubs player jersey would you like to get to commemorate opening day here in Chicago? Welcome to The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman. Here on 720 WGN with you till 11 o'clock. Tonight we got a great show lined up for you to kick off this great week. It's got a good feel, right? It's nice out. You know, the weather's starting to turn. A Cubs home opener at night. It's a good feel. Cubs owner Tom Ricketts is going to join me and talk about the home opener security and the latest Wrigley Field renovations. Sure, it's good for the players, but how about the fans? Also talk about his back and forth with Mayor Emanuel, about security and whether or not they should close those streets around the ballpark. Also tonight, the Joffrey Ballet announced the creative team behind the new Nutcracker coming out this Christmas. It's a who's who of Broadway being brought to Chicago for the new telling of an old classic. The artistic director, Ashley Weider, will join us. This is interesting. I'm fascinated by the idea that you take something like the Nutcracker, which has been performed countless times, and rewrite it. And that's what the Joffrey Ballet is doing. It's very ambitious and creative, and I'm actually very happy to be a Chicagoan. When I hear that, kind of make no small plans, and that's what the Joffrey Ballet is doing. And Food & Wine magazine just put out their list of the best new chefs of 2016. And Chicago represent. Chef owner of Elizabeth, Elena Regan, was chosen. And she's going to be in studio with me tonight after 9 o'clock. We'll talk about her career. And my guest tonight at the big table, author Lee Eisenberg. Eisenberg's new book is called The Point Is, Making Sense of Birth, Death, and Everything in Between. While writing this new book, did the former editor and in-chief of Esquire stumble across the meaning of life? We'll find out at the big table in the 8 o'clock hour. And tonight it's time for the worst. It's our game show we do every Monday night here on The Download. Want to know what's the worst? When your iPhone is on shuffle and one of those Force U2 tracks come on and you got your hands full and you can't change it. Oh, that's the worst. No, don't play. What is it? I don't know. I don't understand this clangy guitar. And then Bono starts singing. You're like, no, I need to get rid of this thing. How do you get rid of this thing? That's the worst. Also, you know what's the worst? The guy who double parks on Ashland. That's the worst. You know what? It's 5:30. I'm just going to double park and go see if my girlfriend's home. Tonight, Amy Guth and Chicago improviser TJ Jagodowski will be our panel, and we are going to give away stuff. So 312-981-7200. That's the worst. Coming up, 9:30. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier. Traffic with Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman, and I'm Justin Kaufman. And this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. Okay, well, let's kick it off here. It's time for the carryout. This is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Well, it was revealed that the police department has been keeping tabs on activists and protesters using surveillance and undercover police officers during marches. So the next time that guy in a turtleneck tries to sell you weed and asks to borrow your phone, yeah, that's a cop. The head of the water department resigned last week. This after the health department said they're going to check pipes for lead. That's not an arbiter of bad things to happen. The water commissioner's like, I'm just going to quietly back up out of this room. Crane Chicago business columnist Greg Hines predicted a Cubs World Series before the state budget deal. Really? You know you're hitting new lows when people are thinking the Cubs are going to win a World Series before you do your job. I didn't know that state budgets were sport. And if that's the case, may I please have that paper bag, Pete? Thank you. Okay.
Yeah, I'm from the state of Illinois. Go
Illinois.
Speaking of baseball, Congressman Mike Quigley joined the Cubs in asking the mayor to close streets around the ballpark during games for security reasons. Mayor Emanuel said that that was a swing and a miss. Really? He said that? When did the mayor become Bruce Valanche? Is he going to start writing for the MTV Movie Awards next? Donald Trump is mad. What? He says the GOP nominating system is crooked. This after the Colorado caucus went to Ted Cruz. Wait, the presidential nominating process is crooked? What? Are you serious? That's funny. You weren't saying that 3 months ago. So when you win, you're a winner. And when you lose, the system sucks. Did you get that, area dads? Good advice to tell your kids next time they don't win that Little League game. And sad news, Doug Banks died today. The local DJ was currently on V103. That's hard to hear. Great DJ, true Chicagoan. A new study says that those who are married have a better chance of surviving cancer. When reached for comment to download, single guy was like, yeah, but still, I don't have to pick up my laundry, so I think that's a fair trade. In science news, wild tiger populations are up for the first time in 100 years. When reached for comment, the Minneapolis dentist who shot Cecil the lion said, Ashley, could you hold my calls? I got to go back to the jungle. A thief broke into a Five Guys in Washington, D.C., but he didn't want money. He just wanted a burger. Yeah, he made himself a burger. At that point, do you put everything on it because you stole it, or do you stick with what you like? Because if I were that guy, I'd probably try the burger with the sauteed mushrooms and maybe the A1 sauce. Just to see if I like it, right? In weather, have we busted out? Are we in the clear? Can we come out of the house now? In sports, the Blackhawks start their playoff push for the Stanley Cup on Wednesday with a rivalry showdown with the St. Louis Blues. The Blues are the chic pick for most hockey writers this week, but that's okay. The Blackhawks like being in this spot. I don't think there's anything wrong with a Kaner, a Taze, a Keith, a Crawford, a collective chip on the shoulder. I think it's good. And also, we can't lose to St. Louis. It's just principle. Sorry. It's just not going to happen. We won't accept it. The Chicago Cubs are back in Chicago for their home opener at night. Oh, whoa. What was that noise? Oh, it's the Download's 1980s Cub fan. He must have traveled back through time. Hey, how's it going? Kingman, Buckner. No lights forever. I'm going to go to that McDonald's. Then I'm going to go to Yum Yum Donuts. Then I'm going to head over to the Wrigleyville Tap. After that, I'm going to pay $5 to watch myself a Cubs game in the day because there's no lights. What? What? Thank you, Download's 1980s Cubs fan. The Cubs are 5-1, and they got the Reds tonight, who are also 5-1, so good baseball early. The White Sox are back on the road with a set against the Twins. They were postponed yesterday, which gave them a sort of unofficial day off. They haven't had a day off yet this season. What? Are people just clamoring for White Sox baseball that the MLB is like, more! We need White Sox every day! Don't you give them rest! The Bulls. Man, oh man, the Bulls. Didn't make the playoffs this year, but you know what? I have a feeling that was Fred Hoiberg's plan all along. Start small, have the expectations as low as you possibly can for 4 or 5 years, play about 500 basketball, and then leave for a college program. Is that about right? It sucks to watch Golden State and Steve Kerr get ready to break the Bulls' record on Wednesday night. They got one game left against the Memphis Grizzlies. They win, they get 73 wins and the regular season record. If they lose, ESPN anchors are probably going to jump off a cliff. And finally, the MTV Movie Awards were last night. That's still a thing? Really? Which pop stars kissed? Do we really need MTV to tell us what the best underwater sex scene was? Or the best actor who didn't wear underwear? I mean, come on. Actually, who won that category? Just interested. Well, that's the carryout for April 11, 2016. Hey, we gave you more chili flakes than you needed. Why? Because we think you're hot. Coming up, Cubs owner Tom Ricketts on the changes at Wrigley Field and hope in the home opener. That plus our 8 o'clock, we're going to talk with Lee Eisenberg, the author of The Point Is, making sense of birth, death, and everything in between. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, coming up, we're going to talk with Cubs owner Tom Ricketts. Big day for them. I'm going to ask him whether or not he likes
the home opener at night or during the day. It just seems weird. It just seems like a regular Tuesday. It just feels like a Tuesday, not a home opener. Mark Tier, what do you think?
Well, I can tell you that productivity around the city was probably up because it was a night game.
But I would say that everyone mindlessly acted like they worked. There was a lot of pounding the keyboard like,
yeah.
But they really weren't doing it. They were waiting until, you know.
Yeah, they George Costanza'd their day. They just looked frustrated all day.
Oh, so busy.
Oh, man. I just can't believe it. Home opener.
Are you a big baseball guy?
You know, I think 162 games is a little much.
Yeah.
I pick it up towards the end of the season. Love the playoffs.
Right.
Love the World Series. I'm a big Pirates fan. Sorry, Cubs. That's and I was okay. ecstatic when the White Sox won the World Series in 2005. That was a lot of fun.
You're more of a hockey guy, and here come the which I thought was really interesting. You're not supposed to call it the NHL playoffs; you call it the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Yes.
Why?
No, because you're playing for one of the most coveted trophies in all of sport.
Hmm.
I mean, that thing is. You ever stand next to that thing?
I've seen it.
It's awe-inspiring.
Yeah. It is. It is. It's pretty amazing to know that that's. That was on a boat in a remote Canadian lake with Jonathan Taves.
That's look, winning the World Series, no doubt, a huge deal.
Right.
But their trophy leaves a little to be desired.
Right.
All those flags. That's a lot of flags.
That's a lot of flags.
Got to be really careful with that thing. You will never see the World Series trophy at the bottom of somebody's pool.
Right.
A la Mario Lemieux.
Right, right.
Yeah. Never happened.
All right.
You won't put your baby in between the flags of the World Series trophy, but you will put it in the top of the cup.
Yeah,
you can't make a Jell-O mold.
You've convinced me now. I'm never going to say the NHL playoffs ever again. It's the Stanley Cup playoffs from here on out. You've convinced me. You win, man. That's
but great. No, I do like baseball. Yes.
All right, Tom Ricketts coming up after the news. We are one with the Cubs we're in love. Yeah, hold our head high as the underdogs. We are not fair weather, but foul weather fans. Like brothers in arms in the streets and the stands. It's magic in the ivy and the old scoreboard. The same when I stared at as a kid keeping score. In a world full of greed, I could never want more. Someday we'll go out. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, it's opening day at Wrigley Field, which in most Chicago circles amounts to a holiday. The Cubs have started the season on fire, going 5-1 on their road trip. They're home tonight, taking on the Reds. But you know what? Tonight, it's not just about baseball. Fans are back in Wrigleyville, and even though a lot of the area is still torn up, building for the future, the charm remains. Injuries notwithstanding, is this already shaping up to be a magical year on the north side? It's the home opener, so who better to check in with than the owner of the Chicago Cubs, Tom Ricketts. Mr. Ricketts, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Nice to be on.
So let me first ask you, what does the home opener mean to you?
Well, you know, I think it's the best day of the year. I mean, it kicks off what I think will be a very, very exciting summer. And, you know, I just like seeing the neighborhood, too. Like, you know, basically this neighborhood just kind of blossoms and everybody comes out and Wrigleyville becomes Wrigleyville. So it's just exciting. And obviously, with all the momentum and all the excitement behind the team, it's even more exciting.
You know, this is a night home opener. It's kind of a new thing for the Chicago Cubs. Do you feel any difference? Do you like it one way or the other?
You know, I think I'm a little traditional on the openers. I probably prefer a day opener. But, you know, we were out on the West Coast last night, so I wouldn't have been able to work this year. So, you know, we'll see where, you know, whatever we got, I'll take it.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about the amenities for the players, new locker room, batting cages. How important was it for you to get the facilities upgraded for this season?
Well, it was very important to me personally, and I give the players a lot of credit for the patience they've shown us the last few years. You know, for several years now, we've been planning to get the clubhouse fixed up, and we had the worst clubhouse in baseball, and now we have the best clubhouse in baseball, but It took a little longer than we anticipated it would with all the delays and setbacks we faced. But it's all good now. The guys came and saw it last night as they came back from the West Coast trip, and they're starting to trickle in now, and I think they're pretty pumped.
It's a difficult proposition to renovate a locker room at Wrigley Field because it is an old building. It's hard to work around. It's not like you could just tear things down. Did that cause problems for you when you're thinking about renovating the guts of Wrigley Field?
Well, when it comes to the clubhouse, there was really no way to build a world-class clubhouse underneath the grandstand where the old clubhouse was.
Yeah.
So we moved the new clubhouse to basically what is a newly dug basement, which is underneath what will be the plaza. And so we literally had to create the space to create a clubhouse. And it took a lot, obviously took a lot more work and time and energy and money for that matter. But it was the right answer for the team. And so, it is definitely something that other ballparks don't really have to worry about as much as we do. But, we found the workaround and everyone's happy.
Well, let's talk fans. I mean, a lot of renovations still underway, but last year we saw the bleachers, the video screen. We're getting closer to seeing sort of the pedestrian pavilion around the ballpark. What can fans expect from Wrigley Field this season?
Well, most of the things that happened this offseason that ultimately will help fans are kind of behind the scenes. I mean, we're restoring a lot of the, we're redoing this, steel, concrete, electrical, plumbing, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of fan amenities that were built into this phase of the renovation. As we go forward, fans will see more points of sale and more washrooms, more things that will make their game experience better, some more clubs, some better suites, those kind of things. But this year, kind of the way you left it in October is the way you're going to see it when you get back tonight. And the so there's not that much for fans, but going forward, each successive year we'll have more and more.
Well, that's nice to hear when we left it in October.
Yeah, right.
That's always good, right?
Next year when you interview me, when we left it in November.
Right. I want to ask this question. How important is it for you to balance the renovation, what's going on inside the park, but also around the park with the tradition, the charm of the neighborhood? We've seen, even stuff that's not Cubs related, but the end of, some of the more traditional stuff like the McDonald's across the street, or even before the renovation, the Yum Yum Donuts, or, all the different things that people have known Wrigley Field to be or Wrigleyville to be. How important is it for you guys as the Cubs organization to balance that with the charm of the neighborhood?
Well, you're the first person to ask for the Yum Yum Donuts back. But anyway, I understand the question. Well, first of all, there will be a McDonald's in the hotel once we get that completed. So it's not like it'd just be a couple of years in between taking the one that we have now and putting it into the new building. But, I look at it a little bit bigger than that. What we're missing at Wrigley is the true beauty of the ballpark that got lost over the years. Like, one of the things that we did this year, and you can start to see it, is we're renovating the outside of the ballpark to match the way it looked circa 1935. So when William Wrigley was the owner in the 20s and 30s, they did a lot of improvements to the park that Charles Wingman built. And the improvements were not just practical, but they were also very aesthetic. And a lot of those nice features, the exposed brick, the terracotta tile, the decorative wrought iron fantail patterns, different things that were at the ballpark that made it beautiful. Over time, as those things got replaced, they basically got replaced with chain link fence or some other very inexpensive and unattractive type of solution. So, we're restoring, maybe we're not putting back the donut shop, but that was gone before I got here, by the way.
Right. That's where you put your bag, right? That's where, after it was Yum Yum Donuts, if you couldn't bring your bag into Wrigley, you'd check it at the Yum Yum Donuts place.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. I remember that. But anyway, but what we are doing is making Wrigley look like what your grandfather saw when he was a kid. It's really going to be beautiful, and it's not quite done all this year. It'll take a few more years to get all the renovations, but if you walk on the west side of the ballpark, you'll begin to see what we mean by restoring the real beauty of Wrigley Field.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, today, you know, Representative Quigley was talking in the media about security, going back to the issue of asking if we can get street closures around the ballpark on game days. He mentioned that Wrigley Field was built at a different time. It was built when there was trolleys and horses and things like that, so there's a lot more access to the street. The mayor has so far been somewhat reluctant on closing any street traffic around the ballpark. What's your stance on security? I know you guys added the metal detectors, but the idea of closing streets around the ballpark.
Well, first of all, I mean, we are doing everything we can to execute really a best-in-class security strategy. There's metal detectors, which are obviously something that the fans will see. And, you know, going forward, we want to make sure all the fans get to the park a little earlier to make sure that they don't have to wait in line any longer than necessary for the metal detectors. There's also a lot of things behind the scenes that we're doing from a security standpoint that we don't discuss and hopefully make us a more secure place overall. With respect to the street closures, you know, we think that ultimately that's the right answer, but we also understand that we're in a neighborhood and these things have to be discussed. So, you know, we'll continue to have those dialogues, you know, that dialogue with our city offline, and hopefully everything will turn out the way it should.
Well, Cubs fans have always felt like something's going to get in the way of winning it all. That's just the way we operate, right? what do you say to your fans after the season-ending injury of Kyle Schwarber? I mean, that was a freak occurrence that happened in the first week of the season. You know, a lot of you know, rubbing your forehead if you're a Cubs fan. But what do you say about this team that might be different than some of the teams in the past?
Well, obviously, Kyle will be missed on the field. You know, obviously, he's a really, really good young man. He's also a very good player. Any team that lost a player of his caliber would, you know, would feel it. But, you know, but the fact is, this team is very deep. We've spent years building a team that is made to withstand a long season and a team that is made to withstand some of the setbacks you find in a long season. Obviously, you know, this is a tough one because we all know Kyle and he's such a great guy and you wish he could be on the field with his teammates, but you know, they'll be out there picking up the slack, and I think it'll be just fine. The key was having a lot of depth and you know, building a team that can withstand some of these setbacks.
Mr. Ricketts, as the final question here, as you just, you know, witnessed the first week of the season, here's the home opener. Tell me about your emotional swings. I mean, do you get really into the ups and downs of a 162 game season in the playoffs like the rest of the fans, or have you sort of settled in knowing how to follow a baseball season now that you own a team?
You know, basically my mood is determined by whether the last game was a win or a loss. I mean, each of these games to me are very important. You know, this is a season where we have real challenges. We've got a very, very tough division. We've got high expectations. We have to deliver on the field. You know, I mean, you can ask my kids how we reacted to the Arrieta home run yesterday. Like, people are jumping up and down in my house. Like, we care. And I think I care as much, if not more, than even the most hardcore fan. But, you know, I also have the perspective of understanding that it's a long season and you can't get too wrapped up in any one game or any one series. So you take a good start with you know, keep it in the right perspective and realize it's just the beginning. And you look at our division and you realize how tough it's going to be with, of course, the Pirates are off to a good start. The Cardinals are a great team and the Reds are off to a great start too. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a long, fun summer, but I'll be living and dying on every pitch.
we'll be looking forward to a long, fun summer. The owner of the Chicago Cubs, Tom Ricketts, my guest tonight. Mr. Ricketts, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. You know, it was great talking to Tom Ricketts. I'm glad he took some time out there. That was good. You know, you don't have a good chance to talk to those guys as much as you'd like. You know, we're not a sports radio station, so it's hard to get guys like Theo Epstein or mm-hmm. Tom Ricketts or Rick Hahn or mm-hmm. Kenny Williams on the show. When you do, it's funny, too, because I wanted to ask him all about the team. Then I realized that, you know, he's an owner.
Yeah.
you know, at a certain point, he's not going to be like, well, you know, I like what Lester does against right-handers. But, yeah. but he seems like the kind of guy that probably would do that.
I mean, he knows, I'm sure, and he'd be happy to talk about it. But, yeah, he's not, you know, he's not like the manager.
I wonder if he gets mad. I wonder if he gets mad like, oh, God, I got to go to this interview where I talk about renovations and security. All I want to do is talk about batting average.
I bet you he probably does. He's probably sick of hearing about renovations. But you have to talk about it.
Well, I mean, I'm fascinated with what they're going to do. You know, you could see how they're kind of digging up on both, like, sort of extended left field, like out to the parking lot there and on Clark Street and some of the other areas. But they really want to do that pavilion style where there's not going to be any cars. I mean, a lot of it, you know, is on the surface is about security. You know, they talk about no cars being on during game days, but something tells me that's moving in a direction almost like the old State Street here in Chicago, where they're going to make that a pedestrian sort of pedway, and everyone just kind of aimlessly walks around because they do it anyway now. If you go to a night game tonight, if you go to Wrigley Field, they got Clark Street shut down at a certain point. They're like, no, man, we get so much foot traffic. We can't have you blazing through here with your Honda Civic tricked out with the cool neon lights, you know, blowing a yellow.
No.
While people are crossing to go to home opener at Wrigley Field, right?
Yeah. No, you can't. You can't.
What's the story? You're the Cubs fan.
Yeah. Well,
this team, you're excited so far? 5-1 is good enough for you?
Yeah. Well, last week, the game they lost, it was, you know, they were in Arizona. Yeah. It was late, and we were here watching the end of it. They blew it. And I was, like, standing up. I was, like, pacing. I was like, man, I'm already pacing. It's third game. I'm pacing watching the Cubs.
It's true. I saw that.
I was like, I had to sit back down, reel it in a little bit. Had my Rizzos this morning.
Yeah. You got a Rizzo cereal?
Yeah. Which is exactly, it's cereal. It's the most generic. It's like.
Is it really Anthony Rizzo cereal? Or you made it up?
No, it's real.
Really? He's got his own cereal?
You get it at Jewel. It's you look at the box and it's like somebody like used their word processor and put his stats on the side.
Startup company. We will put stats and Xerox faces of third year players on boxes of cereal.
Yeah.
Did you pay a markup for it? Is it considered like artisanal cereal? Like, is it like sort of like if this was Brooklyn, it would be like we made our own. It's like we made our own soap. We made our own cereal box.
What's the opposite of artisanal? That's
Jewel.
That's the Rizzo's cereal.
I just love that I think that there's just a guy in like a warehouse up in Ravenswood who's making right now like specific boxes of cereal, not the cereal but the boxes, and Xeroxing people's faces on it. Oh, Addison Russell had a good game. We'll call it Russell-O's. Russell-O's, that's what he is.
Yeah, that's a good
Mark Russell-O's. If there was a Mark Russell, oh, man, we're on to something. I had a good idea for another game we could play on the show, which is nicknames. My buddy Tommy came up with this. The idea of, I think it's high time that if we are sold, let's say that instead of us, like, being overconfident or... You know, or being sort of grab our head and worry about the future of this team. Let's just say we're sold that this team is a perennial playoff team that is going to steal our hearts and minds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
Hearts more than minds, probably. They all need nicknames. These kids are too young. They don't have nicknames. There's no nickname for Jorge Soler. There's no nickname for Addison Russell. There's no nickname for Rizzo. Does he have a nickname?
No. There,
Chris, you know, Bryant?
There's Brizzo, you know, you know, the mashup of Chris Bryant and Anthony Rizzo, their bromance, the Brizzo.
Like, Miguel Montero doesn't have a nickname. And I'm not talking like
Miggy.
Short. No, you can't shorten their name. That's not a nickname. That's like, you know, hey, I shortened their name.
Yeah.
And like, does Anthony Rizzo's friends call him Tone?
See, again, hockey and baseball here, guys.
Yeah.
Doug Gilmore, when he played, his nickname was Killer.
See, that's what I'm saying.
Killer.
Rob's onto it. Let's do a coordinated, patient nickname game where we, the WGN Radio, the Download, we'll do some polls, we'll put some stuff on the website,
yeah.
We'll do it up, but we will be the ones who pick the nicknames for the Chicago Cubs 2016.
Yeah.
Each player, all the way down. We'll start with the guys in the bullpen. So we don't give you Chris Bryant right away. He's not until August. But, you know, we start with, like...
Justin Grimm.
Yeah, Justin
Grimm. Reaper.
Grimm. Yeah, right. And people call up, and the best gets a prize. Grimm Reaper. You're not even playing yet.
Call Anthony. We can call Anthony Rizzo Caesar.
Caesar.
Ah, yeah.
Oh, we are so on to something. We should do this. We should do this when we come back. Pete and I are going to be out next week. We're coordinating our schedules well, I'm doing it for spring break. You're doing it for your honeymoon. Mm-hmm. So that's the same thing.
Yeah.
Same concept. but yeah, so we'll be out next week. But the week after, we should start it. We should do like an hour of call in and pick three guys and then have people call in with their best nicknames.
Chris Bryant, the kid.
The
kid.
What would be Jason Hayward? Haymaker.
I could go that round, I guess. Yeah.
Chin strap.
Yeah.
Because he wears a weird chin strap.
Yeah. The helmet.
Chin music. Chin. Chinny chin chin. The three blind mice. Mice.
We call Schwarber the knee.
Limpy.
See, I think we got it. We got it. All right. A new game. Coming. Now we need to hit a promo. I got to hit up Duffy and get a promo. A new game from Download. Nicknames. We'll do that. Let's do that.
Pencil it in.
It's in. Welcome back to the Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, what makes us human? Is it the fact that we're self-aware, that we know at some point we're going to die? Or is it our stories, our ability to collect memories? Well, that's the focus of the new book, The Point Is, Making Sense of Birth, Death, and Everything in Between, by former Esquire editor-in-chief Lee Eisenberg. In the book, Eisenberg explains that we all have a little writer inside of us, creating the story of our life, with a beginning, middle, and ultimately an end. And in this discovery, somewhere is the meaning of our lives. I love it. Lee Eisenberg's also the best-selling author of The Number, and he lives right here in Chicago. Lee, welcome to The Download.
Good to be here.
I love the concept. I mean, it's almost like a discovery book. It's you talk about this idea of the writer inside of us, and you went looking for that, like almost for evidence of that, and it's really not there.
What's not there? The writer or the
fact that
both?
This has come out before, the fact that there's a, you know.
Yeah, well, I took on a rather modest topic, which is the meaning of life, right. As if no one had ever tried that before. It was Jesus, Buddha, Confucius, Oprah Winfrey, everybody's, Dr. Phil, everyone's tried it. But I had reached a point in my own life, as I think most of us do it, at some stage that I looked around and I said, what is this all been about? I'd been running all over the place, different jobs, different careers, different industries, different cities, winding up here in the most beautiful city of them all. I said, well, what if I took some time and really thought about this? I probably hadn't thought about it since I was a teenager up in my room reading Catcher in the Rye. And I said, wow, what a great idea. And then 2 weeks later, after I got the book contract, I said, where on earth do you start? So I guess I followed three parallel paths. The first is I started reading like a madman. I went to a university library and started reading, and I quickly realized I was not going to read everything that has ever been written about the meaning of life. The second thing I did is I started talking to people, just everyday people of all ages, from millennials up to people in hospices, practically, asking them, have you had a meaningful life? What was the most meaningful chapter? What was the least meaningful chapter? What was the most important turning point? And so on and so forth. And then the third thing I did was, and which actually turned out to be the most fruitful thing, was I started rewinding my own life, sort of mining my own memories, trying to figure out, had I missed anything? Was there a moment, an event, and a relationship, an insight,
an epiphany,
something,
whatever it is,
that opened up the vista of why I was here. So those three paths basically were the challenge that I had to interweave to write a book.
What I love about it is you're really, discovering the idea that we're storytellers, that our life is really about the stories and the memories we collect. And you start the book with this concept of the scribbler. Mm-hmm. Talk about the scribbler. We all have a scribbler
inside
of us.
Well, that was the aha moment. As I thought about my own life and listened to other people talk about their lives, I realized, not an original thought, that we all have the story of our life. Justin, I can ask you right now to tell me the story of your life, and to whatever degree you wanted to, you could tell me in whatever detail you wanted to.
Right.
So we all have this story, and because I spent most of my career as an editor and a writer, I think I know something about how stories are constructed, and it's dawned on me that what we do silently without ever thinking about it was right narratively the story, and it begins with our earliest memories, and it continues on through midlife, and it, you know, it doesn't end, the story doesn't end until it ends. And I ask myself, well, what's the process by which that story gets written in our heads? You know, and we're on the radio, so no one sees the air quotation marks. But every time I say "write," put it in quotation marks. And then I was reading something by Martin Amis one night, and he was talking about how someone asked him the usual question, which is why do you write? And he basically, his answer, his kids ran into the room at that moment, and he said, well, I guess if you really pushed me on it, I'm writing for my kids so that someday, long after I'm gone, they might have a good idea of what their father was like, how he thought. So suddenly this light bulb went off in my head, which is that we all have a little Martin Amis. I mean, God forbid, right? If you've ever met Martin Amis.
I haven't, no.
We have this little middle-aged Brit with bad teeth living in our heads. And it doesn't matter if you're a man, you might have a woman writer, or a woman might have a man writer, or a transgender writer. It doesn't really matter. But it's as if we do have this ghostwriter, this story writer, somehow nestled between the folds of our brain, maybe working on a teeny tiny laptop and maybe smoking dope for all I know, but whose job it is, beginning at age 3, which I can explain if you want, starts to collect memories and then almost as a writer or as a film editor or whatever you want to say, combines those memories into chapters. The chapters become how we identify the various passages of our life. So it gave me an opportunity to sort of dip into how real writers write, which I think is very strikingly
similar. What I love about it, Lee, is that, you know, there's evidence. I mean, to have this idea that, okay, so it is interesting, the idea that, yes, well, let's say we do have a writer in our head, and that's sort of who's putting together the story, the beginning, middle, end of our story. Mm-hmm. It's a new concept, but it's not, because I think about there's evidence along the way that some of the great thinkers of our time have thought this way. Just the idea of, quote unquote, the midlife crisis, or you write about Shakespeare. You know, Shakespeare kind of lays out, this is the story of our
lives.
He laid
out the chapters, as did Dante. You know, that's not a new idea here. And there's a whole new field, by the way. In fact, one of the better departments of teaching this field happens to be at Northwestern. It's called narrative psychology. And what narrative psychologists believe, and it's really central to my book, is that without that story, if we didn't write that story in our heads, think about that, life would make no sense whatsoever. It wouldn't be coherent.
Right.
Existence wouldn't be coherent. So we actually take that story. It's not just to flatter ourselves or write a book about ourselves. We create that story so life has some coherence. Otherwise, it would be strictly chaotic.
Or you could say life has some meaning, right?
Yeah.
There you go. The book is called The Point Is, Making Sense of Birth, Death, and Everything in Between. It's written by Lee Eisenberg, who was a former editor-in-chief at Esquire. Let's take a break. We come back. Let's talk about the story, where it starts. You said the idea at age 3, and we'll talk about that when we come back with Lee. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table, Lee Eisenberg. He's the author of The Point Is, Making Sense of Birth, Death, and Everything in Between, former editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine, and he lives here in Chicago. Lee, in the last segment, we talked about, you know, when that story starts, and it's really about when you start to collect memories. You say the age 3.
Yeah, well, this is actually – I'm not making this part up. This is actually
– the rest is all made up.
I don't even live in Chicago. I do live in Chicago. There's a lot of studies, neuroscientists, cognitive psychologists, ton of studies that try to figure out how and when do our memories begin. And if I were to ask you, Justin, you know, what's your first memory?
Right.
You'd have an answer.
I would. Yeah, right.
It may or may not really be your first memory. It may not have even happened. It may have been something that, you know, a parent or a grandparent,
right,
an older sibling told you. It may have been a photograph that you saw in an old family album,
right,
that you somehow turned into an actual memory. There's very, very little, and I've interviewed tons of people who insist that their first memory happened when they were 6 months old. It's not possible. But usually around three, it could be two and a half, it could be four, we begin to really collect memories that endure over time. Not all of them, but some of them do. And then as we get older, more and more of them endure. But the most interesting thing is virtually coincident with our beginning, our ability to collect memories and keep memories, another thing happens almost at exactly the same time, which suggests that the two are very strongly connected. And that is we develop our understanding of narrative. We begin to understand what a story is.
Right.
And if you have kids or if you've ever been around a 3 or 4 or 5 year old kid, they are story junkies. I mean, they can't get enough stories. And it's also around three that we begin to be able to actually construct our own stories verbally. You know, they're often not very complicated. You know,
right.
Me go poo is not a particularly sophisticated sentence or
it
story.
It could be a bestseller,
but it
still.
Actually does qualify. A linguist right. will tell you that it actually does qualify as an actual story. It's got all the elements. I won't get into what they are. It gets very kind of hairy and complicated. But beginning at age three, we start, as I said earlier, we start taking our memories and we start sort of gluing them together in whatever way we do. And they form chapters and they become the longer saga. And it's really a miraculous process that we can't really understand fully until we really understand what's going on in our brains that actually does create and keep a memory.
Well, you know, I kind of mentioned at the top about, you know, what makes us human, the idea that we're self-aware. But you know, it can be argued, and it is argued in the book, that what makes us human is having a narrating mind, that the ability for our species to be able to tell a story in the way that stories are
told. That absolutely.
Told.
Well, as far as we know, we yeah. don't know if canaries yeah, right. have stories in their mind, but it's highly doubtful. But that is obviously one of the things that makes us human. I started keeping a list, actually. With all this research I did, I came up with dozens of things that make us human. Another thing that makes us human is where we know we're going to die, which may or may not be connected to your story. It usually is. That makes us human. I don't think our pets know they're going to die. And a great philosopher once said animals are immortal as far as they know because they have no knowledge of death. Another thing that was supposed to make us human, but it's been disproven in the last several years, was we're the only animals who want to and know how to cook their own food. Well, several years ago, there was a study done with monkey or chimps, and apparently a chimp, if given a choice between a cooked slice of sweet potato or a raw one, will always go to the cook. Now, I don't know if he could actually cook the sweet
right,
potato.
Right, right, but he could tell the difference.
But he
right.
clearly gravitated toward
right.
it. So, but no, this story is obviously something that makes us human. It's way too complex a process for my canary to know how to do that.
So you've got, I mean, you kind of break it down with four kind of categories. You say our life story is ever changing. You have the narrating mind, which we just kind of talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Without our beginning, middle, or end, our story, we feel incomplete. That's a big part of,
we don't know where we are.
We don't, right?
In the journey.
And the fourth is, and this is the one that I really like, is that storytelling makes us human. The idea that telling our stories to the next generation, you mentioned it earlier in the interview about, you know, why people write. But, you know, there is this kind of concept that we have this ability to do this. And a lot of times we don't think of it that way. But really, inside of the concept of storytelling may be the meaning of life as we are looking for.
Well, what the theme of the story is, or what what the takeaway of your life story is, your private life story, is generally going to be the thing that tells that suggests to you whether your life has been meaningful or not. But, you know, like a novel. I mean, it's really no different from having read a novel. If you read a novel, it's got a beginning mm-hmm. and a middle and end. It's got turning points. If I asked you right now what Justin's turning points have been, you would rattle them off, you know, probably without hesitation. They may change mm-hmm. Over time as the story goes on. So yes, we know how to do that. But I think what's really interesting is when I ask people, because I write a lot in the book about diaries and keeping a journal,
yeah.
because I think there's a really, we may want to
talk
about
that
a little
bit later, yeah.
Yeah, but when I ask them, why don't you keep a diary? I can't write. You know, there's this, I'm not even a good storyteller. I hate to get up in front of a meeting and tell a story. I'm a bad joke teller. You know, so people have a very, very low level of confidence about their ability to tell stories. And yet they don't give themselves any credit for creating this remarkable story inside about themselves, in which they are the leading character, the hero or the heroine.
It's really interesting, and that really gets at the core of this book, the idea that people say, I don't tell good stories, yet your whole life is a story. Everything that you do is your story.
And you're continuously editing it, revising it, throwing out, you wish you could throw away chapters and delete them entirely, run them through a shredder.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about that concept. I want to talk about the elbow, which is a big part of the book. But you know, telling stories and living stories come with roadblocks. They come with curves. Sometimes they don't play out the way you think they're going to play out. And you talk about that from your vantage point as an editor, as a writer, as a profession. Lee Eisenberg, the former editor-in-chief of Esquire, is in studio. The author of The Point Is, Making Sense of Birth, Death, and Everything in Between. He stumbled upon the meaning of life. They're going to look back to this interview and they're going to say, Lee had it. Lee got it right. We'll talk more with Lee Eisenberg when we come back here. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Lee Eisenberg. He's the author of The Point Is, Making Sense of Birth, Death, and Everything in Between. Easy topic. I mean, you should have done a gardening book. That's a lot easier. Tell us how to cook kale. That'd be easier than the idea of making sense of birth, death, and everything in between. But really, I mean, to refresh, the idea of the story of your life is the meaning of life.
Well, the story of your life is the place you look for the meaning of life. You can look at the story of your life and say it has no meaning. What one of the things I really wanted readers to take away from this book is if they really sat down either retroactively and examined the story as if they were reading a novel, for example, they might begin to see clues if they feel they don't know what the meaning of their life has been or what's been meaningful about their lives. That's probably a better way to put it. I don't set out to tell every man, woman, and child alive or as yet unborn what the meaning
right.
of life is. If
you
I
make
could
a lot
that,
of money,
I wouldn't be sitting at the
I was
big table.
Say, it's really nice that you wrote this book.
But I do believe that if you go back to that story and actually not only think about the story retroactively, but think of the story as it's happening a lot more deeply than you do, perhaps in our busy lives, you may find many, many more meaningful moments in your life as it progresses than if you don't pay attention to the direction of the story.
You have a lot of different things. One of the things that I really like is that you borrow a concept from financial planners, the idea of what would you do with 24 hours to live. And applying that concept, and they do that to say, what would you do with your money or how would you do it, to your story.
Yeah,
to sort of think back in your head about, you know, you got 24 hours to live. What are you going to remember? That's a good way to sort of.
That's not what you're going to remember. I learned that. That's part of an exercise that I wrote a book about financial planning some years ago. And there was a Zen practicing financial planner, brilliant, brilliant guy, who believed that financial planning, I don't want to get off on a digression, was done entirely the wrong way. That we run around saying, how much do I need?
Right.
And we never ask ourselves, what do I need it for? And he felt until you know what would make your life meaningful, beyond food and shelter and, you know, the basics, you really don't know how much you need in your final decades because you don't know what you need.
Well, then how do you apply the 24 hours to this?
Well, so he has this exercise and the three questions. I'll talk about the third one, which is the one you're referring to. The last question he asks is you have only 24 hours to live. It's not, what do you want to do in the next 24 hours? It's a question that you can ask in two ways. They mean the same thing. Who did you not get to be, and what did you not get to do? And he would argue that your number or how much money you need really needs to be built around those two things. Well, at the end of our life, leaving money out of this now, it's very, very common. Gerontologists would tell you that most of us go through what they call a life review, in which we look back at our lives mm-hmm. and we ask ourselves in various ways, what did it all mean? Was it all worth it? You know, well, why was I here? What was the point of that? And my argument in the book is that if we pay closer attention almost in the moment to how that story is going along, we may not have to ask ourselves
right.
at the end of the day. We will know where the meaning, presuming there was some meaning, where the meaningfulness did lie in our lives.
You know, I mentioned before the news the concept that it's not that easy. I mean, our stories, the stories of our lives have roadblocks. They have curves. They get off track. You know, you talk about the toughest part about your story, which is it's a term in writing, the elbow, the idea of like how do you get through that part of middle part. That,
well, that's the midlife, yeah. You know, the infamous midlife crisis for the most part, which is, you know, there's no specific objective. When does midlife start and end? But typically a psychologist will tell you it's sort of between 40 and 60. The elbow is a term that I don't think anybody really ever heard of until I wrote this book, but it was a term that we used back at Esquire. We would get all these articles in, often from very famous writers and well-paid writers, and you'd start reading, and the first half of the article was fabulous, and then it would start to rattle and shake and run off the rails and get very confused and start repeating itself and didn't go anywhere.
Like
and,
life.
And we started calling that section the elbow. Right. In effect, that was the midlife of that article. And, you know, we could speak in shorthand. Well, the first part is great, but, you know, the elbow's really effed up, and, you know, it's great until the elbow and so on. So as I was writing this book and thinking about middle age, I realized that we all enter this period of life that we could call the elbow.
Right.
And even though there's just infinite amounts of information, some of it sound, some of it not, about the so-called midlife crisis, it does very much track what often happens in a novel or a story or anything, where you sort of you get into it and then the writer just runs off the side of the road and so on, doesn't really know where he or she is going. So I think if we think about our elbows, the elbow of our life a little more carefully, there's no reason at all it needs to run off the road. In fact, there's a lot of studies that have been done, psychologists have done, that a great many people, when they do their life review, when they're, you know, in 60s and 70s and 80s, a surprisingly large number of people will point back to the elbow, their 40s and 50s, and say that was the best. Those were the best chapters of my life.
You know, one of the things you also talk about is this concept of generativity. I guess that's the way.
That's the fancy word for it.
The concept of doing something with your life, leaving the world a better place.
That's what generativity. Yeah, is. Generativity is a fancy word that Erik Erikson, the psychologist, was so important in developmental psychology. He coined it. It's a really simple concept, and we all live to varying degrees, either within it or rejecting it. But it's basically doing things on behalf of people, the next generation, people who will survive us. Now, obviously, our kids are the most direct, you know, recipients of our own generativity. But, you know, whenever you walk in a charity walk-a-thon or teach a kid to fly fish or volunteer at a school or
help the planet, whatever it is.
Recycle bottles of cans. We are doing that not for us. We're doing that for human beings who will outlive us, some of whom we don't know and will never know. And it's a very, very powerful force that operates in many people. It doesn't operate, unfortunately, in other people. But what it really seems to suggest to me as I read more and more about it and to others is that it's almost a kind of symbolic immortality. You know we're not going to live forever. Mm-hmm. But some part of our story, if a part of that story is to have helped a kid, if part of that story is to have helped build an institution or a church or keep a community vibrant or, you know, whatever it might be, part of our story, in fact, lives on. So, in fact, our lives may end. In fact,
they do.
I hate to break the news.
Right.
Spoiler alert. But our stories don't necessarily have to end. They live, our story or pieces of our story will live on in the stories of other people.
The other part of it, you know, there was another term, stagnation, the idea that, you know, sometimes you're having a hard time figuring out how to tell your beginning, middle, and end, or you can't figure out what your story is. And there's actually a term for that, and there's a concept that maybe there's something psychological that's standing in the way.
Yeah. Well, often the Erik Erikson, the psychologist, argued that unless you have at least a dose of this thing called generativity, this caring for the future generations, your life will be stagnant. You'll be down on yourself. You'll be sort of bored. You may be shiftless or directionless and just frustrated, and you ain't going anywhere. You're not going anywhere, and your story ain't going anywhere. And the chances are, when you go, your story goes along. Goes with it,
right?
Because you haven't implanted pieces of your story into those stories that live on beyond you.
Okay, so let me ask you, you know, because we mentioned earlier on about the diary, about the journal, and there's always seems to be, and even in my end, we write for this show, I write casually, I've written before for profession, but I never think about telling or writing down my story. How important is it for us
Well, I've kept a diary only once in my life. It was only for 23 months. I totally and completely forgot that I had done it. I started it right before our first child was born, and I ended it shortly after our second child was born, and that was the end of it. And I hadn't gone back and read it for 25 years. But I still have it, miraculously. It was tucked away in a hard drive that had somehow survived 8 Apple Macintosh operating system upgrade. It even survived Steve Jobs himself. It was extraordinary. But it got me interested again in why do people keep diaries, and what's the point of keeping a diary? It isn't to write your life story, but what it is intended to do is serve as a vehicle for you to write down insights and observations or thoughts or fears or funny things or whatever it might be in the moment. But not to make a story out of it.
They're the notes. I mean, it's the notes of your life. I mean, you're going
to
put together the story.
It's notes to self, basically. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
And it's important for this project.
Well, it's totally important because, first of all, and this has been proven by tons of research, we vastly underappreciate things when they happen to us. We're all very busy. We have hectic, busy lives. And we walk down the street and we have all kinds of thoughts, all kinds of insights that we say, oh, I'm going to make a mental note of that because, that was one, that was interesting. And two, I just had this most fantastic insight into that. Oh, I'll make a mental note of that. Well, you know, mental notes, you know, they go nowhere. But if you kept a journal, and it doesn't have to be fancy, it could be a cheap thing from Walgreens or something, and just made a note of that insight, those insights have a way of both surviving time, but they also have a way of changing over time. And it's just absolutely a given that we underappreciate moments of beauty or moments of intimacy or moments of just blinding wisdom that we might have about something. We underappreciate it at the time, but when we go back to it, which a diary allows you to do, sometime into the future, it takes on a whole new aspect or a whole new meaning. And a lot of people say, well, I don't have to keep a diary because I'm on Facebook or I tweet.
Right.
And I'm on Facebook.
I hope that's not my diary.
But keeping a journal and tweeting are not the same things whatsoever. I mean, some things should not be shared. Some things are so incomprehensible at the time that you can't share them except to yourself in a diary. I'm sorry I didn't keep a diary for longer, because if I were to go back to that diary when I'm 80, my guess is it's really going to help me with that life review. It's really going to help me see the story in a way that I can't really easily reassemble simply out of the memories that I managed to hold on to when I'm 80. So I think it could be a very, very powerful and very helpful thing for us to be able to
do. You know, to get into this book, to, like you said at the beginning, to research it, to go through the three things that you did, and to have it out and to internalize it, to have everything done, to go on the tour, to talk to people about it. What's the impact of this kind of research, this kind of theory, thesis on you personally?
Exhaustion.
But are you looking at your life?
Frustration that I can't get more interviews like this because Donald Trump is running for president. There are certain aspects to my life that I feel much better about having done all this work, all this thinking about it. One of them is that, you know, like every other parent who ever walked the face of the earth, if you had asked me at any time, my kids are mid-20s, if you had asked me at any time up to my writing this book, what do you want most for your kids? The answer is I want them to be happy. Well, I want them to be healthy too, but that goes without saying. I want them to be happy. We all say that. I don't say that anymore, and I don't say that anymore because what this book. It's not that I want them to be unhappy, but no. What I say now, if you were to ask me that, is I want them to lead meaningful lives. And the reason I say that is because I came to understand that you can't be happy. You can't wish happiness on anyone unless they are leading for them, not for you, the parent, but for them, a meaningful life. Happiness is nothing in itself. Happiness is a byproduct of something else. It derives from something else. And we all know people, I've known people very close to me in my family who've led lives that they did not see any merit in. They weren't productive enough. They didn't even try to be productive enough. And they were not happy people. They were restless. They were bored. They were frustrated. They were a little bit angry at the world. It's because they couldn't extract enough meaningfulness from various things. Now, you don't have to be wildly successful in a career. You don't even have to have a career. If you indulge your creativity and don't deny the creative reservoir that we all have, and I don't mean being a great writer or painter. It could be a hobby. It could be watching birds. It could be anything at all. If you don't entertain that, then chances are you're not going to get meaningfulness from that. If you don't have a very strong, intimate relationship with at least one other human being, warts and all, chances are you're not going to find life is very meaningful. If you don't give enough back, these are all ways you can extract meaning from life. You don't have to do all of them. You can just do one of the things I'm listing, and you will have access to meaningfulness. But if you don't have access to any kind of meaningfulness at all, anything that really means something important to you, you're not going to be happy. So it's kind of useless to say, oh, just be happy. You know, what is that?
And all that informs the meaning of our life and the story of our life, which is what this is about. The book is called The Point Is, Making Sense of Birth, Death, and Everything in Between. The author is best-selling author Lee Eisenberg. He wrote the book The Number. He's also the former editor-in-chief at Esquire magazine. Lee, thanks so much for being my guest tonight at the big table.
Thank you, Justin.
Now Lee's got me pontificating.
Thinking about...
Just thinking, I'm trying to be mindful.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Give back.
Exactly.
For the next generation.
Oh, that's what it's for? Oh, I thought it was more just to give back. I don't know. It's like I was trying to make a grocery store joke. I thought it was time giving back change. It's interesting. The idea of writing your story down, or at least going through that exercise to sort of understand where you've been, who you are, I think that's great. The beginning, middle, end, the conflict, the resolution, what kind of person you are. Doing that exercise and kind of, I think that would be a tremendous thing to do, and then to be able to see what comes out of it.
I remember after I was let go of my last position, I was like, oh, man, I'm going to write about this. Such a good story. Like, the things that I have seen.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know, first day, got my computer out, sat in bed, typed up a nice little intro.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. Four years ago.
And so it was a really good blog post.
I didn't post it anywhere. It's sitting in a document somewhere. With the title. I don't know if I saved it under anything.
You should do a really great way to write would be to maybe start in the middle or like at the end and then go, whoa, 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 back it up. Let's start at the top. You know, like a Scorsese kind of thing. That's what you should do. And there I was holding the box of stuff, leaving the room. Whoa, whoa, whoa. How did I get here? Well, started out in Oak Lawn.
I don't, there's not a lot of cocaine in my life, so I don't know how Scorsese it would be.
I think we're onto something. I think we should do a Scorsese parody to a mundane life, right? That's, what would that shot be? Like taking a sip of your cereal where it comes in, oh, yeah! Like every third shot on vinyl.
I'll take it. You'll have the spoon, but then it just goes into like sugar instead. And then I put in my coffee.
This was the pre-sugar days of Pete Zimmerman. Maybe that's what your story is. Your story is how you gave up sugar and you stuck to it.
So far.
So this has been, I mean, this was a New Year's resolution that you were going to go, I guess for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've done
the
it.
Life
I mean,
decision.
We're in April.
I still miss it every single day.
Really? Do you feel it? Do you like, oh, man, I wish I had sugar right now? Do you feel yourself like sort of thinking that way?
Only with coffee, like especially on the weekends. Not so much during the week, but on the weekends when you just want a nice cup of coffee and you want to put some sugar in there, I do miss it.
What do you replace? Meth? Meth? You're putting meth in your coffee? What do you do?
I don't put anything in there.
You haven't found like a replacement? To sugar?
I've tried, various sweeteners, NutraSweet and Equal and stuff like Sweet and Low, and that, and I just don't like the way they taste chemically. So no, I'm sucking it down dry, if you will.
If you will, in the parlance of our times. Okay, well, I mean, but you've done a great job. I mean, my New Year's resolution was to wear a V-neck sweater every day.
Yeah, and you were on a roll.
I did it, but that's contingent on the weather. Once you get, I can't wear a V-neck sweater over a collared shirt today. It's 50 degrees. So now you start to sweat a little bit. Everyone's like, hey, Mr. Winter, you know, where's your, where, you know.
What about a V-neck T-shirt?
I could go that, yeah. Or like, someone needs to come up with a V-neck collared shirt. I know on the surface that sounds impossible. But I know there's a lot of inventors and innovators. Maybe we can get Steve Gadlin
to
do
work
it.
Work on it, yeah.
The collared V-neck, right? Like, bring that back. Like, you can make it, like, kind of, like, I guess you could do that. You just put, like, little stains in there. Yeah, that would work. Yeah, but that's been the problem lately, just in the last, but I did a pretty good job. I mean, even throughout the whole thing.
I bought rolling there.
12 V-neck sweaters. That's just the look that I had over and over and over. Every day, a different muted color. I'm Justin. So now I have to start thinking about what's going to be my... I should add, there's a New Year's resolution, and then there's a mid-New Year's resolution. Mm-hmm. So what's that going to be? I think I need to go to like the blowout sale at Steve Harvey's warehouse, get myself like 3 or 4 really colorful jackets.
Oh, yeah.
And then be that guy.
Yeah.
You know?
We haven't had a guy like that since like Tim Weigel.
Right. I could be that guy.
Yeah, I don't know if you want to be that guy.
Well, people would, what would happen is that I think people, especially since we're here on Michigan Avenue, they just think I'm that one guy who's on the bridge who's dancing in the green or yellow or blue suits.
That guy.
Yeah. So then everybody would be like, they gave him a radio show. That's awesome. I don't know if I want to do that. So I'd have to figure that out.
I wear a nice blazer every day.
Yeah.
You have a bunch.
I know. I have 3, but thank you. I have 3 that don't have. You know what happened to my one, which is terrible, is I got a hole in the elbow of the jacket, of the sports jacket.
I mean, how do you do that?
I think it's just the way that I sit. I've always got my elbows on the desk.
Yeah.
That's where to sit down. That's a ridiculous thing. So I take that. So now I've got to go professor-like patches. I guess you could do that.
I like the patch.
Yeah. So I'll have some options, but maybe you're right. Maybe I just get a couple of jackets. Do it up for the spring.
Yeah.
For the spring, summer.
No, when I'm watching Saturday Night Live and I've noticed that Colin Jost always wears the same tie. It's like a brown suede tie and it bugs the heck out of me. I'm like, come on. You work one day a week. Put on a new tie, unless it's his lucky tie. I think he's coming to town in June.
When we had him on. He talked about growing up in Staten Island. We should. You should get him on just the
first question.
What's with your tie, bro? All right, coming up, Elena Regan is here, a great chef, the restaurant Elizabeth. She was chosen by Food & Wine magazine as one of the top best new chefs in the country. We'll talk with her coming up here after the news, so stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up at 11. Coming up a little bit later in the hour, we're going to play the worst, 312-981-7200. My panelists tonight, WGN Radio's Amy Guth will be here, as well as Chicago improviser TJ Jagodowski. They will sort of lead us through the worst, but the star of the show is you, 312-981-7200. If you don't know how it works, it's pretty simple. You know what's the worst? The guy who always has to shake your hand, right? He's always up in your grill, always having to shake your hand. No, it's okay. We can say hi. We can head nod. That's the worst. You know what's the worst? A rug burn from an inflatable slide. Oh, that's the worst. That's the worst. Those are coming up. 312-981-7200, the number. Well, earlier this month, Food & Wine magazine announced the 2016 Best New Chefs. And for the 7th year in a row, Chicago was represented. This year's choice, Elena Regan. She's the owner chef behind Elizabeth and Bunny the Micro Bakery, which just opened this year. Regan's also planning a casual Japanese restaurant called Kitsune. Not a bad couple years for a Chicago chef who started at age 15 washing dishes. Elena Regan, welcome to the download.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So what does it mean to get this? I mean, this is a big deal, and it seems like... you know, you've had a lot of accolades in your career, but this one, I mean, this is almost like it's a great sort of indicator of future success.
Yeah, it's really amazing honestly, I'm still kind of processing it. I have known about this award for years, and I've worked at restaurants when chefs have gotten them. And it was always something that has been in my mind, but never an expectation, or I wouldn't even have known the first way about going about it other than, I guess, the route that I've taken, which is extremely hard work. But, you know, I don't have, you know, contacts or, you know, I don't have a PR company, so.
You're not schmoozing it up at the food and wine headquarters? Hey, no. Let me get this glass of wine.
No, and, you know, a lot of that just seemed for me potentially unattainable because if those were some of the prerequisites, I didn't have them. So it was amazing to know that they had been checking me out. Mm-hmm. Come to find out, it had been several years in a row that there were unannounced visits, obviously. So when I got the call, you know, I was just really in shock and really happy. And that's it. I guess, like I said, still processing. I don't really know what to say about it except that, like, I am just thrilled to be among the class of those who have gotten it in the past. I mean, just not even the chefs among the Chicago area, but Thomas Keller and Daniel Boulud and some really amazing chefs.
Impressive list of chefs, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Do you feel at all, like, I mean, obviously this is a kind of a loaded question, but do you feel any extra added pressure getting that that award? I mean, because of the chefs, like you just mentioned, the names that are on that list?
Yeah, I don't know if it is pressure, it's not from anything external. It's definitely internal. And it doesn't ever take, whenever there's any kind of accolades, I never feel like, oh, sweet, we're just going to roll with this. It's like not resting on my laurels by any sense. So it's definitely internally a push, like, all right, this is great, but how do we keep this going and really, you know, live up to what has been, you know, awarded or given to us.
And you own two restaurants. You're a chef at two restaurants, the Elizabeth and Bunny the Micro Bakery. You got a third one on the way, the Japanese restaurant Kitsune. I mean, you mentioned hard work. I mean, this is not an easy livelihood to be able to run a restaurant, be a chef in the restaurant. I mean, I was sort of apologizing to you for having you come down on a Monday because I know that, you know, days time off is very scarce. But you talk about where you get that work ethic. What does it take to be a chef in a successful restaurant in the city of Chicago?
For me personally, that's the thing, like you're saying, is to come on a day off. And honestly, while I'm not physically there, I'm definitely mentally. So I'm kind of always working in a sense. And so what I may have is an obsession with it. And so obviously there's passion and love and interest and creativity, and all of those things are fueled, by this, but, I'm sure if I went to a psychologist or a psychiatrist and told him about it, you know, there would be some mental health issues.
Not good. That's probably true. You work how many hours?
A lot, at least, you know, 16 a day, sometimes less, you know, it just depends. But and then there's, you know, again, just a lot of the mentally being there without the physical. But
is that something that as a chef that you feel like that came from you and your personality and your relationship to work? Or is that something that's taught from the people in the kitchens that you've worked for, other chefs, and the idea that this is really not just a job, it's a 24/7, you know, experience?
Yeah, I think that there is some of that internally. I definitely, I came from a family that had strong work ethics. I mean, my dad was always working, and some of the restaurants that I've worked at, I had seen that, you know, very hard work, long work, lots of pressure and thought behind it. I mean, Gran Ackets is a perfect example. I worked at Trio in my early 20s and at the time was going to school for creative writing, which completely satisfied that creative part of me. But I very much looked up to the way that he thought about his restaurant and his food. And I applied that to the same way that I worked on my writing. And that creativity and that love and application transferred over when I decided to take the career path that I did. So, yeah, some of it's definitely learned from I watched people do it and saw how they were doing it and how passionate or obsessed they were. Mm-hmm. And luckily having a similar love for some of the industry and maybe it's mostly even the escapism of the creative aspect, but either way have just kind of applied that. But I definitely think it's in me too, because I think people can be very passionate and love something, but not necessarily have all the components to see it through.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Chef Elena Regan is in studio with me. She just was announced to be one of the best new chefs for the 2016 Food and Wine magazine list. And talk about your restaurant, your style, your creativity, but also where it came from. I mean, I kind of joked in the beginning in the lead about, you know, you started at 15 washing dishes in Northwest Indiana area. So we'll talk about your life in the kitchen. We come back here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Chef Elena Regan. She was just named to the 2016 Best New Chefs list for Food and Wine magazine. She, of course, is the owner chef behind Chicago's Elizabeth and Bunny the Micro Bakery, one in Lincoln Square, one on Broadway and in Lakeview. And Regan's also planning a casual Japanese restaurant called Kitsune, which should be out sometime soon. I referenced right before the break that, you know, you started washing dishes at age 15. Mm-hmm. You grew up in the area. You grew up in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, in Hobart, Indiana.
So talk about that. So that's a true story. You started 15?
Yeah, I started at a restaurant. It was actually in Crown Point called Via Victoria. It was an Italian restaurant. And, yeah, I was washing dishes, sometimes bussing tables, sometimes putting together salads. But I worked hard. I mean, the waitresses always seemed happy to have me around.
For you, you know, you mentioned about the career path when you were at Trio talking about creative writing. When was it that you realized that not only did you have a passion for this, but you had a skill?
I had worked in restaurants throughout all of college, like I said, since I was 15. So that was something I always said to people when they asked, what did I want to do someday? And I always said own a restaurant, but I always thought it was something I would do later in life. But I had worked back of the house at many restaurants and front of the house at many restaurants, had all kinds of positions throughout that career. And it was just one day that I decided, like, I'm going to go for it. And so I started my own company, pretty much just growing things in a garden and taking them to farmer's market and then making some prepared foods and taking that and just trying to get a name out there. And eventually people started picking up some of those items and writing about them. And so that was kind of that jumping off.
Was that hard for you? Was that hard for you to make that jump? Or was it something that you felt you were destined to do?
No, it definitely felt like a destiny. And it wasn't hard either, because what I had been watching is, in a sense, other people do that. I had seen over the years some other friends who were chefs open up small places. That's back when the kind of boutique fine dining restaurant started, and you know, things became even more chef driven than they had been. So I was seeing friends carve their way, and not only that, but I was seeing people come into the restaurants that I worked at having those kind of small things that they were growing or things that they were making. And so I saw the duality of the entrepreneurship and thought, if I start there, then I could probably build myself up to hear.
One, I mean, Elizabeth is a Michelin-starred restaurant. Obviously, you're getting this huge honor for the Food and Wine magazine. But a lot of the creativity comes in not just the way that you plate stuff, but the food that you actually present. I mean, there's a whole you've created and, you know, dedicated your life a little bit to foraging. Talk about the concept of, right, of foraging.
Well, I think the most interesting, like, point in my mind is that I was decided I was going to carve my path to owning a restaurant. And so I thought, well, I need to reteach myself some kitchen work and some finer kitchen work. So I got the French Laundry cookbook to read it front to back. And there was this beautiful picture of Connie Green walking through the woods with a mushroom basket. And I thought, I know how to do that. So that's what happened. When I started entering the kitchen again, I took that approach because that's what... It was actually the first time I really saw that somebody was making a career themselves out of foraging. So I thought, okay, I know how to do that, so I'm going to incorporate that into what I do. And that's kind of how that started. I mean, my father and I, we would go to my grandfather's farm and hunt for mushrooms ever since I was little. I mean, as far back as I can remember, and one of my earliest food cooking memories is sauteing chanterelles that we got on his farm. But the big one we looked for in the mushroom we looked for in the fall was the hen of the woods, which is also called sheep's head. That's what we call them in Indiana. And that is what is said. Look for the sheep's head near the base of a tree. And that's the way to locate those. But, yeah, so I just incorporated what I knew growing up on somewhat of a small farm. My mom did a lot of canning. My dad did seed saving. You know, that's how people were.
You don't see, I mean, that stuff is lifeblood stuff. I mean, I know a ton of families grew up in a rural town that would do that, but you don't see that necessarily translate or move to a fine dining Michelin star restaurant in Chicago. I mean, that's really where you took your creativity and took foraging to another level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was, I took what I knew and then I added the creative part that I was talking about earlier that is really exciting and fuels me. So, it was a combination of just taking two things that I love, being out in nature and inspired by that, and taking what I knew from growing up and the Midwest and putting those both together in, you know, somewhat of a different, interesting way.
You know, now you're moving on to your third restaurant. I mean, for you, do you see that as the future for you to sort of build this restaurant empire here in Chicago? Or
no, it's stressful, and I'm very much a control freak, and so I don't think that having more than three is really feasible because I can only be at one place at a time, unfortunately. Right. And the bakery works because I can be there during the day, and Elizabeth at night. And Elizabeth is always going to need me at night. That's really my number one.
What are you going to do? What are you going to do when the third place opens?
So the third one, I have one of my sous chefs. He's been with me a little over a year. His name's Mikey Mudrick, and he's been really excellent, has learned a lot, and I've learned a lot from him, and we work really well together. So he's going to be the head chef, and while I collaborate with him and coach him, I'm going to give him more creative responsibility, more managerial responsibility. I have a couple more people on my team too that have been with me for a while that will also take on some more managerial positions at the new place. So that's where I'm kind of stepping back a little bit, like, okay, yeah. I'll let these guys take the reins.
You mentioned creative writing earlier. You mentioned that you didn't think you'd get into restaurants this quick, or not quick, may not be the right word, but you thought it'd be when you were older. Do you imagine a life of yours without restaurants?
No.
love it. Chef Elena Regan. And you know what? I'm happy to hear that. I think we're all happy here in Chicago. Who the owner chef behind Elizabeth and Bunny, the micro bakery, which is in Lakeview, and the casual Japanese restaurant Kitsune, which should be coming up here in the summer, spring,
yeah,
summer?
Definitely the summer, and that's in North Center.
It'll be in North Center. Elena Regan, congrats on the food and wine
Thank
list,
you.
And thanks for being our guest tonight.
Thank you.
It's going down,
y'all. All right, my favorite night, my favorite segment. It is Monday night, and that means it's time for the worst. Oh, wow. We're back here on Monday night. It just seems like that. 312-981-7200. We're playing the worst. It's a pretty simple game. As I said before, you know what's the worst? Double parking on Ashland. Who double parks on Ashland?
Businesses fail there because you can't park anywhere
right.
there.
Right. Like, but the one guy is like, you know what? I need to jump in right here.
Yeah.
I'm gonna throw the hazards on right here and just
do this
for like 15. I'm just gonna take a 15 at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday. or the Peapod guy. That's the guy's like, I'm just gonna double park it right here. The worst, of course, is where we collectively bemoan about the problems of our society. In studio with me, TJ Jagodowski.
Hi, Justin.
I was gonna say local improviser.
Oh, sure.
Does that work?
Oh yeah, I'm local. I fit both those.
And from WGN Radio, Amy Guth. Amy,
hello.
Good to have you back. She, of course, hosts the Saturday Night Special, 7 to 9 when there's not sports.
That's right.
Sports.
Sports are the worst.
She's also working on her documentary on online harassment. How's that going?
It's also the worst. It's going really well. I mean, every time I think I've heard the most horrifying thing, I hear more. The internet giveth so much. But there's still a lot of people that are doing a lot of good work on to try to fix it and try to make the internet a more civilized place to be. Mm-hmm. And so it's been cool to meet all of those folks and see what they're doing.
Well, hopefully this can be cathartic for you. Because you can play the worst and talk about the worst of internet comments. Okay, so we're playing for first place tonight. We still have tickets to Beer Under Glass 2016. These are VIP tickets for the fundraiser for the Garfield Park Conservatory, which is coming up in May. It's also the launch of Craft Beer Week. So they take the craft beer party, and they put it in the Garfield Park Conservatory.
That's the best.
Huge party. That's the best.
That's number one.
Number two will be a complimentary registration for up to four riders at the MB Bike the Drive on Sunday, May 29th. So you can get into the Bike the Drive, which is the coolest thing ever.
That's the best.
And then third is a Lou Malnati's Pizza.
Oh, that's the best.
So there you go. Three the best, but we play the worst. Pete Zimmerman is here as well. Pete, how you doing, bud? You ready for this? You want to start us off?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So Pete Zimmerman's going to start us off as he does every week. Pete, what do you got?
The worst, sitting next to Justin Kaufman during fantasy baseball season.
That's not even cool. That's not the worst. That's the best.
Hey, did you hear Juan Uribe had three hits today?
It really is. It's becoming a little bit of a – it's only been 1 week, and I've already dropped six people. I've done a bunch of trades. I'm way over the top.
It really is the only way you're going to keep Juan Uribe on your radar, though. Like, really? He's still playing.
The catcher for the Reds is playing in this game. The catcher from the Reds is on my fantasy team, and I just watched him bat. I didn't even know what he looked like. And I watched him bat for the first time. I'm like, this guy's got to go.
Yeah,
he's off my team. Tomorrow I'm going to make a trade. I need a different looking catcher. All right, 312-981-7200. There's already some stuff coming in. Why don't we start with you, Amy? What do you got?
Oh, my gosh. I have so many grievances to air, but I'm going to start with good old-fashioned mansplaining is the worst. Mm. Oh, it is the worst, and it makes me so mad. And my rule is that I'm going to treat people kindly and respectfully no matter what they're doing to me.
Right.
Like, your behavior doesn't dictate my manners.
Right.
But I really struggle with that when it comes to mansplaining.
See, what Amy, what mansplaining is...
Good.
That was my attempt. What Amy's trying to say is that mansplaining is when men... interrupt and essentially explain.
I said something about getting mansplained the other day at a camera shop, and I put it on Facebook, and my friend posted, she was, where do mansplainers get their water? From a, well, actually.
Oh, nice.
That's good. All right, mansplaining. All right, TJ, what do you got?
Florida.
Just in general.
It's the worst.
Do you follow that Twitter account, A Florida Man?
No.
It's funny.
But, like, I didn't, but this is how I would say you know Florida's the worst. That you could make something up and just something horrific. Like, There's a guy who makes meth out of babies, for babies, and then goes around and just sets arsons to like schools and churches.
Right.
And then if some of you are like, what? And then you were like, oh, it's in Florida. The fact that person would go, oh, right.
Oh, right.
That means it's the worst.
I was in Florida 2 years ago at spring break, and the main story on the news was about a peeping Tom, right? And it was about a guy who like had looked in a window and ran, and they put his composite like up there, and it was like a shady kind of gray thing. And it was they'd CNN'd it. Mm-hmm. Like this Clearwater like news, they went like that breaking news. Let's go back to our top story of Peeping Tom over in the whatever subdivision, and it went all. I was there for like 4 days. By the third day, they're like, update on the Peeping Tom story from Monday. Still no word. I was like, come on, there's got to be something better than that.
But if they put up just like a picture of a creepy dude, if you live in Florida, you're like, okay, this is everybody I know. This is one of 40 people that I know within a stone's throw of my front door.
All right, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. What did I do with my, I had my phone somewhere, I lost it already.
You know what, I just lost my phone too. There's like a phone vortex happening in here today or something.
You know, it's the worst when you lose your phone.
That.
All right, here's what I have. This is good, this is, okay. You know what's the worst? Guilt tipping on carryout. Is the worst.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I go in for carryout, and I'm like, I just feel like this guy's going to like me a little bit more if I drop a couple dollars. And I find myself, like if it's a nicer place, like kind of like a chic, cool, like you're in there, you're like, hey, I got a ton of money, man. I got a ton of money just like you guys. Here's $4. And I'm like, why did I just give him $4 for this pasta that I ordered that was already overpriced?
And then you invent reasons to be like, oh, he's been answering the phone all night. He bagged it. He like stapled the top. That's
he
where
stapled yeah. the top.
That's
worth so nice.
Something.
He offered me a water while right. I was waiting.
That's
was nice.
Okay. That's 40 cents plus the 30 for Staples.
Exactly. So there you go. That's good. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
No, it's just so busy.
Yeah, this guy.
He's probably doing this volunteer.
Right. And who knows what other stuff has happened in his life might help to make up for. You know?
It's just $4, yeah, Justin, for right. once. For once, give back to the community. All right. 312 says, you know what's the worst? My friends.
Aw. You gotta get yourself some new friends, my friend.
312 says, the worst, required class with boring lecturer, old outlines, and Scantron exams.
Ooh.
Oof.
Old outlines.
630 says, the worst is when you win a pizza 3 weeks ago and nobody contacts you to get the prize. Yeah. You know what? I don't buy that because I know that Pete Zimmerman is on it. So this is just them trying to get a pizza out of it. I'm on to you, 630. But you can have a pizza. I don't care. You can have it. It's all right. All right. And 312 says the worst is Good Times. All right. Well,
the old TV show?
Or maybe they mean the worst, this is Good Times. Like, this is good segment.
Like, yay, the worst. Good Times.
Yeah. Or they're down.
Or the theme song to Good Times was filled with a lot of things that were the worst, like easy credit ripoffs and stuff like that. Maybe like. For the worst, see Good Times.
Comma.
Print lyrics. That one just might have been cut off part of the way through.
That's true. That's true. I mean, there may be a second text that we missed. Yeah. There's a lot going on. All right, let's take a quick break. We come back. We will continue with the worst here on the download. 312-981-7200. It's the worst here on the download. It's Monday night, 312-981-7200. You can call, you can text, online. We have tonight, you can win tickets to the VIP to the Beer Under Glass, which is the fundraiser for the Garfield Park Conservatory. You can win complete free registration for Bike to Drive or Lou Malnati's Pizza. TJ Jagodowski, Amy Guth are in studio with us. TJ, an improviser here in town with the great show TJ and Dave.
Aww.
Also, you can see TJ everywhere. Amy Guth, WGN Radio, the Saturday Night Special, 7 to 9 when there's not sports.
That's right.
And working on the documentary on online harassment.
Indeed.
Let's get to some of these texts. All right, 630, the worst is when you don't understand / laugh at Louis C.K.'s jokes, but the other person you're watching his stand-up with is dying laughing. That's good. Could be anybody, but right. That is a good one. That's yeah. A good one. It's just so depressing.
Right. Also, he's become the measure of hip. So yeah, if you're right. Not getting it, you know where yeah. What side of the line yeah. You're on now.
Yeah. Like, no. Yeah. And that always happens to you one time. Right. You feel I always feel like, oh, I'm totally in. Then he right. Does a joke, and I'm like, well, I know what happened. What? Oh, no, it's happening. Yeah.
It'll be the day you're like, this music is too loud.
That's exactly it. All right, so let's see here. 262 says, the worst, getting a project for a top client while paired with the one guy at the office that gets along with no one.
Mm.
Ooh. Ooh.
That's a tough one.
Yeah,
I guess. For that guy.
Yeah, that seems like a...
if yeah. You don't know who that person is,
it's wrong.
You're that person.
the person's listening right now. It's like, it's, I don't understand anything about that. 312, this is appropriate and a little bit, you always got to have a little bit of potty humor.
Sure.
This is appropriate for Wrigley Field tonight. Mm. 312 says, the worst is a shy bladder at the old trough.
Oh, that's rough. It's rough.
I don't have a comment because yeah. I have not seen that. I've just heard
just
tale
the worst.
Of this horrifying.
It is the worst. I think peeing at Wrigley Field is the worst. You go in there and you feel like you just press up against somebody else's jeans, and you just pee into a
that's
long
awkward.
Silver thing.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah.
So there's not dividers. It's
no.
Just a trough. No.
Nope.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's almost like if you shared a cell with someone, imagine that. Like,
yeah.
You'd be doing 2 to 4 without a dump. Like, for certain. That's just that exposed toilet,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Right by the head
it's
of somebody's
jail-like.
Bed. Like, you're
yeah.
Not doing it.
It's just, very jail-like. Yeah. And I know that there's a lot of renovations that are happening at Wrigley Field. I would love to see if they renovate the troughs.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody pees like that anymore. Maybe they were in the 50s. Maybe they were in the
30s.
They loved it in the 30s. They couldn't wait.
When I first moved to Chicago, I lived very close to Wrigley Field. And I came in, came home one night. And it was right after a Cubs game. And just craziness everywhere. Just people throwing up on each other and all kind of stuff going on. And I get to my building and there were people having sex against my front door and I couldn't even get into my building. And I was like really tired and I really want to, and I was like, can you move? Can you get out of the way? And they're just not even listening to me. Finally,
I move?
Can I ever?
Ain't you been watching?
I was really kind of like, do I walk around the block again? Like, this is really weird. What do I do? So I walked around the block again, and I came back. They're still going. I was like, okay, I really got to go. Because at that point, I really had to pee, so I had to go inside. And I was just like, yeah,
it's
I live
rent,
here.
You're paying
yeah.
Money to live. You don't have to go around the block and
it
hope they
It was really
finish.
Awkward, and no one was ever me.
You probably have to call the cops on that one.
They eventually went away, but not without confrontation. They were trying to do, I guess, the equivalent of having sex on a front porch of snuggling. They were just kind of like hanging out after by leaning against the door. He was doing the lean. It was really awkward for everybody.
That's the worst.
If you could actually not touch my door.
So essentially the worst is living in Wrigleyville. Right? That would do it.
Yeah.
That would do it. All right, Pete, what do you got over there?
The worst is when you get a new liquid soap dispenser for your bathroom and you can't figure out how to get that lever to work. You know, it's like it says twist and push down, but that never works. So you're kind of jamming it down. You're like, how does this thing work? Yeah.
I would go the other way too. The ones when you're used to the liquid, but then you get the foam. If you do the foam and you do it too hard, it just spits out and just is all over the place. You're like, I'm so sorry to the bathroom and everything, and you're wiping up soap. All right,
gotta be an easier way.
There's got to be an easier way. All right, let's. You guys want to go through another round?
Sure.
All right, Amy, what do you got?
I'm going to say when you're in a taxi or an Uber and your driver's on the phone, clearly having a very personal conversation.
Mm.
So yesterday I was in an Uber and my driver was, I think, pretty much about to get divorced right there in that moment. Like he was having this really, really awful fight with his woman. But he was trying to have this really quiet voice because he's got somebody in the car. If he could just keep it down. And yet he was saying really horrible, volatile things for her. And at one point he just started going, I said, you spend money every day. I said, you spend money every day. And he just kept doing that. And he was getting madder and madder. And I was like, you could just let me out here. It's fine. It's good.
I know the GPS says to take lower whacker, but don't.
Here's fine. I could just take
the L. Just get out to walk from the rest.
Yeah, that was awkward and the worst.
That is the worst. Anytime an Uber driver is on the phone, it's the worst. But to add that it's actual strife, relationship strife.
Yeah.
It's all personal. Oof. Yeah, you're stuck there listening to it.
All right, TJ, what do you got?
This is pretty specific, but if you've been there, you'll agree. The Wendy's at Western and Addison. It is a horror show.
Did they renovate that one?
Not since time began. Like it was horrific. My one experience there. I had one experience there, but just people yelling at people, and then this lady trying to defend herself, and then the lady's manager like ripped on her as well. And all I wanted was a coffee. And I've never thought like maybe I should punch someone. Like maybe this would help. Maybe like, me punching someone would help.
Oh man, there was a lot of rumors about a White Castle at Ashland and Clark when they come together over there.
Okay.
Like in Edgewater there. Mm-hmm. And this was years ago, and I just remember people saying, "Oh, that gets a little ornery at night, right?" And you could tell like they have the metal things on the windows and stuff. And so we thought it'd be fun to go in there, like just say, "Let's just go check it out. It'd be fun. It's gonna be fun." And that was so wrong to do that. Like we went in, I was like, "Oh my god, man, this went from kitschy, like let's see how crazy it is, to let's get out of here, man. This is not you just don't feel right."
You were kind of expecting like Wiener Circle kind of fun,
I thought it'd be
right?
Fun. Yeah, everyone.
Nope.
No, it was not.
When they swear at you here, they mean it.
There was a lot of staring. I just know that. So all right, let's go to the line. Let's go to the text. 630 says the worst is when the worst is an obnoxiously loud Harley. We get it. We see your overpriced motorcycle.
Mm-hmm. And people purposely make them louder, right? Yeah. Like they don't. It's not even like something's broken. They just made it sound that way.
Yeah. 224, the worst is being an Uber driver and the passenger who gets in reeks of just having smoked a doobie in the closet. That's a very specific smell.
That's very specific.
I like that smell. You know, like, there's a lot of smells. I don't smoke. Yeah. I don't. But I like the funk of that. Yeah. Like a skunk.
Yeah.
Sometimes, like, you don't want to admit it, but, like, there's something sort of underneath pleasant about that. Like, gas. Gas smells pretty all right, you know? Like, a certain earthy kind of, like.
There is. It's natural.
Yeah.
It's natural. 309 says the worst are anti-vaxxers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's generic. I would much rather have you text back with why, because that's a generic thing, or just overall the idea that someone is an anti-vaxxer, then it's just, all right.
Yeah, hey, if it's political. Only because you're exposing my children to polio.
All right, hold on. Wow, these are so specific. This one's so weird. 815 says, the worst is when they tell you to get on the plane. And they say, screw you, I'm getting in the plane.
What?
I think they're questioning on is not what you, that's not the right grammatical way to say you're getting on a plane. You're getting in a plane.
I don't want to blow up the 815. It's a Carlin joke.
Is it?
It's a George Carlin, straight up George Carlin.
Oh,
book.
See, that's it why is. You're here, TJ.
It is.
Oh, that's you.
I can't dramaturg all of these, but that one I can place to a George Carlin routine.
Oh, that's no good. Okay. 630 says, when people don't take ownership of a problem or situation, even if it's not their fault, i.e. bank managers.
Mm-hmm. They're paid. That's why they're paid that money, right?
Right.
To take that responsibility.
That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
630 says, I did win that pizza. I'm not a scammer.
Hey.
So there you go.
Good. This is going to be ongoing. I like this. I like having a runner.
The pizza war.
Oh, man. We may have a front runner here. This one's good. 513. You know what's the worst? When you get a cheeseburger through the fast food drive-thru, and it already has a bite taken out of it.
Oh.
That's got to be bogus. Only because I can only, the psyche, that would mean that someone's like, oh, I love this burger so much when they're eating there. And they're like, you know, they don't eat that stuff.
Yeah.
Right? So, you
I
know,
can't
they're like,
not.
And then
couldn't resist, but was so committed to customer service. I was like, I have to give this guy what he ordered.
He ordered a cheeseburger, but I want a cheeseburger.
What do I do?
All right, let's take a break for the news. We'll come back. We'll continue. We have much, much more texts that keep coming in. 312-981-7200. We're playing the worst here on the download. Stay with us. All right, it's the worst here on the download. Monday nights, every Monday night tonight, my panel, TJ Jagodowski, improviser TJ and Dave. All sorts of stuff. Amy Guth, all sorts of stuff here at WGN Radio. Her show, the Saturday Night Special, and the Business Hour on Saturdays. Also working on her documentary on online harassment. And you're going to be in for this show next Monday, the 18th.
Yeah, I'm going to do the worst.
Yay!
I hope that I'm not the worst at doing the worst.
Oh, that's so great. That'd be so fun.
It'll be good.
I'll tune in from California. I'll find a...
Text me and just say, yeah. You are the worst.
Right, there you go. I got plenty of people that do that. That'll do
right.
That.
I know.
Normally.
We all
don't
do.
Worry about it. Yeah, right.
That
exactly.
Comes with the job.
It's sort of like their job. It's their job to tell us over and over. 312-981-7200. Okay. Let me go to some of the stuff that's coming through here. You always gotta read there. 773 says the worst is being in a queue at Disney World in July behind the guy who has a quote deodorant optional policy for himself.
Sure. Yeah.
I like that they use the word in a queue.
Yeah.
How
very
about
Canadian,
that?
Very Canadian.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Okay. Because he looks so old. I don't know what any of that means.
Well, I have a long...
Go ahead.
While you're reading,
yeah,
I have many grievances to air.
All right, go for it.
The buzzwords are the worst. They're some things are not verbs. And should not be. The biz speak is right. Really a problem. The one I keep hearing... I mean, there's so many that I hear all the time that I think are so terrible and not real words. But one that keeps... That just will not die is calendaring...
Oh,
please make that stop now. Like,
calendaring.
That's when you drain your pasta. Yeah.
Right. Someone said to me with a straight face, let's do some calendaring and figure out a time to meet.
Let's do some calendaring where we can get together to figure out how to monetize.
Yeah.
And
strategic integration of the leverage of the. They're not real things. They're not real words. And like they're
you should be the one in business, like in the tech world, that's like, that's not a word.
Oh, I
that's not a word. Sorry,
constantly.
Can't use that.
My thing is in a meeting, I'll go like anytime I used to be in meetings when I was more kind of in a tech role, I used to always do that. I'd be like, wait, what does that mean? You're going to integrate that. What does that mean? That means you're gonna hit enter.
You mean you're gonna do it.
That means you're going to do that task.
You're going to do that. You're going to integrate that.
5 seconds. You're going to log in and hit enter. That's what you're going to do. Say that. Don't make it up. That drives me crazy. It's like this weird, I think it like it prevents people from having a seat at the table if they like can't speak the jargon.
That,
it
right,
takes people away from it.
It's a shibboleth.
It is.
Right?
All right. 815. Worst is trying to remove a tick off your already panicking child.
Oh, that's pretty. That's...
I've had to do that one time.
There's a video going around Twitter right now. I don't know why, but it's all about removing a tick with a wet Q-tip. That's actually kind of horrifying. And someone like gifted it, so it's just on this loop of just like rolling around a tick. It's super weird.
309 says getting a fingernail in your can of pop as you're drinking
what?
It.
That's not real.
Or maybe their own fingernail.
Under the...
Yeah, maybe they popped it and they broke it.
Ooh. Mm.
Or maybe someone tried it. And then they like failed and they broke their fingernail and they ran and then you got the can of pop. Like, oh, what's this? All right, let's see here. Let's see what we got. 513 says, you know what's the worst? When you thought you went to bed with Jessica Rabbit, but you woke up with olive oil. That seems so specific. All right, 949 says the worst is when the person next to you on the airplane falls asleep with their reading light on for the whole overnight flight.
All right.
Yeah.
That's
pretty
terrible.
Fancy flying the whole overnight.
Ooh.
Where you going?
Ooh.
Yeah,
going
that's
to paradise.
Yeah,
that's a paradise
right?
flight.
I think there's a lot of them around flying, like
yeah.
the elbow.
Transportation, yeah.
Man, the elbow rest.
Everything's heightened there, you know? Like, a lot of stuff can be the worst on theirs. It's so,
it's
like,
tight,
confined
yeah.
and, yeah. And the stakes are high. You could. Very rarely do you go a place, like, for a couple hours where you could die.
Right.
You know,
that's
very rare.
In tight quarters.
Yeah, right.
630 says vegans, the worst. Not sure about that.
Not the worst.
815, Pete, you'll like this one. The worst is ordering a fajita quesadilla and getting a regular fajita and then being charged for said fajita. That actually happened to me. People won't let me forget.
Never
you know
forget.
What's, yeah, I know. You know what's this is a good one, 513. You know what's the worst? When the couple in the hotel room next to you is fighting so loud, but you still can't make out what they're saying because their baby is screaming. That just sounds like a
disaster neighbor right there. You know,
that is the worst.
In the baby category, I like the tick removal.
Yeah.
That's right. In the worst involving babies, I like the ticks on them.
Right.
All right. Let's see what we got else here. You guys got some more?
I got one that's really sad.
Test of time.
So I have a backup if it's too sad. But this is the time of year for it. So the worst is dead featherless baby birds on the sidewalk.
Oh, yeah.
Like pink, tiny,
everywhere.
Yeah, big purple eyeball. My backup is mayonnaise. If that was too heavy.
No,
mayonnaise,
no,
that's bad.
Both of them work.
Yeah.
Both of them, I would say
it's like sandwich lotion. It's terrible. I hate it. So disgusting. Everything about it. I don't get why it's white. What is it? It's what egg it? And oil?
Yeah.
Why does
yeah.
it turn that color?
Emulsification.
You connect that word with mayonnaise. Everything about it is fetid.
Fair enough.
This one's the worst. 847 says, working at the airport and watching someone with an emotional support animal, and that dog goes to the bathroom in the hall. All right, here we go. Jump down here. But the person walking behind them doesn't notice because they're busy on their cell phone.
Ooh.
Oh.
They step right in dog.
Oh, that reminds me of an airport thing. Can I tell you one more? One time I was walking behind Carrot Top. Exactly in the wake of where people felt safe to start saying terrible things about him. So like 25 feet behind him so that there was nothing pretending like you didn't see him. And then I was exactly where everyone was like, oh my gosh, guy's a freak. He's so weird looking. And then I actually felt like, oh, it must be the worst to kind of be Carrot Top and know that that's happening because you probably do hear it always at that distance. Like, do you see his eyebrows? Dude's huge. He's a freak. You know, like it was right where people felt the safety bubble had like.
He's like a 10-second
wow.
delay.
Without a doubt. Oh, like,
man. Do you know that the TSA now has an Instagram account?
No.
Oh, really?
And they post pictures of all the weird crap they've confiscated from people and then really cute support dogs or canine, drug sniffing dogs.
I actually might dig that.
It's kind of fascinating because you're like, oh, ninja stars, really? Thought you're going to get this through. Okay, sure.
I know that guy.
Or that high heel's a stiletto. Really? Okay. Oh.
I hope that's a real ninja.
Yeah, right. 773 says calendaring is a method of making paper surface smoother.
What?
Okay.
There you go.
But so let me
tell
you,
that's not what they mean.
Tech bros are using it to mean look at your Google Calendar and figure out when you want to do something.
815 says even worse than a tick, a leech off your already panicking child.
Whoa. Mm.
Glenn 773. The worst is having a beautiful girlfriend with bad foot odor.
Not the worst.
That's
focus on the hot girlfriend part.
Right. Exactly. You got things going on.
Yeah.
You got things going on.
If you're literally great from the ankles up, you can deal with that.
She's perfect.
You can deal with that.
From the ankles
up.
Yeah,
you can deal with that.
262 is such a this one is when your radio's stuck on AM. And you have to listen to the worst. I don't usually do meta ones because it's like, all right, there's always one every time. But I'm like, I want to stop. What do you mean your radio's stuck?
Right.
Are you like using a paint thinner like thing? A thing you mix with the paint to like change the radio?
Wire hanger on top of that thing, tinfoil to something?
No.
I think it is fascinating the number of people that will text us to tell us how much we suck, but then keep texting. Like, go listen to something else. Yeah. Put a CD on, man. What are you doing?
He can't. His radio's stuck. And he's in a locked room without windows. And
it's like a torture device.
Yeah.
You will tell us where the treasure is.
Yeah. The worst is that
you listen to this AM radio all day.
Right. All right. I got another one maybe is a little bit weird, but this one bugs me, that chocolate is advertised as sex to ladies.
Yeah.
And if you watch a lady in a chocolate commercial, like loving on the little chocolate bite she's having, right? Like it's like the acceptable form of sensuality that women can talk about. Like you can talk so openly about, I love chocolate. Chocolate is so delicious.
Yeah. They do that with flame broiled burgers too. Like the Burger King is like,
for
geez,
dudes,
I don't really
but for ladies, it's chocolate and yogurt. Here's the thing. I don't like chocolate. Uh-oh. I really don't eat chocolate. And when I tell people that, they're like, oh, you don't like chocolate? That's so weird. As if I just said, like, I am totally asexual. I am a Ken doll. Like, people think it's the weirdest thing because chocolate is so intertwined with women's sexuality.
I'm with you on that one because it is always, to me, it's always strange that they get so sexy and there's food commercials.
Yeah, and there's always like some like brown fabric billowing nearby as she's like loving on this little Dove bar or whatever.
Yeah, and like the M&M commercials where they personify the M&Ms and they're
naked.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, come home with me. And he's like, I can't believe it. She's going to eat you, man. And you're like, what is happening in this commercial?
This is not, weird. This is,
all right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we will give away we'll do a little bit more of the worst and then we'll give away the prizes for tonight. 312-981-7200. If you're on the line, we will get to you in just a moment. Stay with us. Get the stories that make the city with unlimited digital access to award-winning Chicago Tribune News. Become a member today at chicagotribune.com. All right. Whew. There's a lot of good stuff, and they're still coming in. 312-981-7200. 815 agrees with you, Amy. Says, my mom actually gave up eating chocolate in 1988. Anytime anyone finds out, they say the weirdest stuff. It's almost like someone died. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, it's true.
Right.
I'm gonna extend that even just beyond with other food related. I think loud chewing, we got to talk about that. Not only is loud chewing the worst, but the level of, like, I get so raged out by hearing the loud chewing that I then get annoyed with myself and I feel like a terrible person. I'm like, why am I so mad? That person's just eating a sandwich.
Right.
That reminds me of, I was just listening, I was watching the Masters over the weekend, and I kind of find golf soothing until it's so quiet that you can hear the dude nose breathing in between the call, and then that's all I can hear is him breathing through his nose, and it's so grating while everything else is like birds tweeting. And then,
yeah, that's totally true.
Yeah,
I heard that too.
Rough. All right. Okay. All right. So let me try to copy this so I remember this guy. That's the problem with dude. I don't have a good system yet on when to read these texts back for third, second, and first place. But let me do this. Let me go to what we have to give away tonight for first place. So if you're third place winner, you're going to get a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's, the home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. Second place, you're going to get complimentary registration for up to 4 riders at the MB Bike the Drive on Sunday, May 29th. Kick off the summer and enjoy Lakeshore Drive car-free and carefree at this 15th annual event. Register and get more information online at mbbikethedrive.org. And then the first place is going to be a gift, 2 VIP tickets to Beer Under Glass. This is on May 19th, 2016, because it says 2016 here. May 19th, 2016, not valid in 2017. This is the fundraiser for the Garfield Park Conservatory, which kicks off Chicago Craft Beer Week. It's a big deal, and we have 2 tickets VIP, which means you pretty much don't have to stand in line for the beer. All right, so let's go ahead and do this. You want to do the top three here? Okay, so number three, can I get a drum roll? Okay, or not. All right, number three comes from 630. It says, hi, I won the worst about 3 weeks ago. My name was announced on the radio, but I was never contacted and told who to claim the Lou Malnati's. You win! That's right, the worst. 630, you're going to get that pizza. You got it. You got
Look forward
place.
To hearing from you in 3 weeks.
There you go. All right, we ready for number two? Number two, here we go. 630 says, the worst is when you don't understand / laugh at Louis C.K.'s jokes, but the other person you're watching his stand-up with is dying laughing. Mm-hmm. This wasn't necessarily about Louis C.K. when we know that feeling. And, you know, that's tough to be on the wrong side of hipster culture.
Yeah, that you admitted that you were that person and didn't put that on someone else. That was very self-effacing.
There you go. All right. So that means that they're going to win second. So first place, the 2 VIP tickets to Beer Under Glass. Let's bring them in and they can explain themselves. On the line with us is Bobby. Bobby, are you there?
Hi.
Hi.
Yes,
okay.
I am.
So Bobby, what was your the worst?
The worst was I work at the airport and I was watching a passenger walk with their emotional support animal. They didn't realize as the dog was walking, he was relieving himself. And the person behind him was so busy on the phone, didn't even realize the dog was going and walked right through it. And not only that, actually rolled a roller right through it. And it was rolling brown dog dump all the way down the turnstile.
Bobby, that's not only the, like, there's a lot of things that are the worst in an airport.
Mm-hmm.
But actually bringing dog poop into the scenario and actually rolling through it, and then that got transferred into the onto the plane.
Yes.
There's that, and you know how planes connect. You know that plane was in Cincinnati, then it went to Denver, then it went to California. That dog poop smell probably messed up a whole day of traffic.
Sure, and stuck in the guy's wheels on his roller beside.
Bobby, how close were you to this, and how close did you get to like, hey, there's a Or did you just like, no, I'm going to let this play out. I'm going to sit back and take this in.
No, we let the person with the roller know what happened because we kind of wanted him to try and clean it off, but it was kind of too late at the time.
Well, this is great. Bobby, congratulations. You get 2 VIP tickets to Beer Under Glass. Stay on the line. Thanks for playing. We appreciate it. All right, so that's going to do it. I want to thank Amy Guth. You can hear her on the Saturday night special here, 7 to 9. Also, the business hour, 12 to 1 on Saturdays. And you'll be filling in here on the download next Monday, the 18th.
That's right.
You don't have to play the worst if you don't want to, but you should.
I kind of want
so
to.
Fun.
It's so fun.
And the listeners are great. It's unbelievable. TJ Jagodowski, of course. TJ and Dave, improviser here in town. That's pretty much it.
That's it. Thanks for letting me be here.
TJ, great to see you. Thanks for playing. And everyone at home, thank you again for playing the worst. We'll play it again next Monday. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, today, the Joffrey Ballet announced the creative team that will be putting together the new Nutcracker next Christmas. It's a who's who of Broadway talent, joining choreographer Christopher Wheeldon. Wheeldon won a Tony for his work on American in Paris. This is a huge coup for the Joffrey to get this crew of writers, choreographers, costume designers, and projectionists together. So what does it mean for your traditional holiday classic? Joining me tonight, Ashley Weider. He's the artistic director of the Joffrey Ballet. Ashley, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
So, yeah, I mean, I got to ask, this is a huge announcement today to bring this team together. I mean, this is a team that has produced on Broadway, has won Tonys, and they're coming to the Joffrey.
Absolutely. And I think that it's been really exciting, and I think that we're glad that we can finally let everyone know who the team is, because I think it is incredibly impressive. And it's also, you know, nobody takes on a new Nutcracker without really thinking it through. And my initial conversation with Christopher Wheeldon was back in 2007, when I was appointed artistic director of the Joffrey, and knowing that there would come a day when we would have to do a new production. I think that the old production served us so well, but things wear out. And so the cost of redoing that production was what made us think, well, what does a new production look like? And for me, Christopher Wheeldon really is an extraordinary talent.
Well, he's coming off a huge, he had a huge run last year. Yeah. I mean, he's American in Paris was a
Tony
big
Award.
Darling, Tony Award winning. I mean, to bring him here to do the Nutcracker, I mean, it's a traditional performance ballet, but it's also to bring Chris in. I mean, you're talking about bringing that sort of Broadway flair. I mean, it's not going to be your grandfather's Nutcracker.
Right. And I think that, you know, when I look at people that are choreographing today, Christopher is so innovative, he's so fresh, it's so inventive. I think also what's really important is that, you know, when we were thinking about a new Nutcracker, what does the story look like today? How is it relative to our inclusion of our society and the diversity of our society? Mm-hmm. And so Brian Selznick, the brilliant, brilliant author, has rewritten the Nutcracker. And I think it is incredibly special because it is set here in Chicago during the Columbian Exhibition. And he's an authority on that. And reading through the many scripts that we have now arrived at the final story, which has given Christopher a real blueprint for where we're going to go. And then you add Julian Crouch, mm-hmm. the scenic designer, costume designer, who did the Addams Family, Hedwig, many, many operas at the Met and at the Lyric. And then Natasha Katz, who has won a Tony last year and has won numerous awards.
How do you get all these these people together? I mean, are they all coming to work with Christopher? Is Christopher bringing his team in? Is that how this works?
Well, I think that he's worked with many people, mm-hmm. but I think that, you know, I have, with Natasha Katz, she lit his Swan Lake when he first did it. We presented his Swan Lake 2 years ago. I think she's an amazingly talented woman, and I think that she brings a really great perspective to the whole idea. And I think that the thing about Brian and Julian and Tasha and Ben Piercy from 59 Projections, they have worked with Chris. So a lot of them worked on American in Paris. Mm-hmm. But they've also, Natasha worked with Chris on his brilliant Winter's Tale, which was a collaboration with the Royal Ballet and National Ballet of Canada, and also with The Adventures of Alice in Wonderland. Mm-hmm. So they've worked together a lot. They know each other. I think that Broadway budgets are very different than ballet budgets.
Right.
And creativity really is at the fore here. It's and I think all of them can look at the issues that we have and find a way collectively of how we are going to make it every bit as magical for the budget that we have.
Okay, so let me ask you, because I would think that you could the Nutcracker is a traditional holiday favorite here in Chicago. I mean, you're not going to find, they're hard to find tickets. It's not like you guys are, you know, going on the street handing out flyers to get people to go to the Nutcracker.
True.
So there's a lot of companies who would have that in their repertoire that wouldn't go and change it because they say this is easy and this is the budget and this is good and we can work on something else. What's the move to change to a more ambitious, more creative Nutcracker?
I think that for me, there are many Nutcrackers that sit very much in the beginning of the 20th century. And when I moved to Chicago, I have always loved Chicago, and I think Chicago has an amazing history. And when you look at the Great Fire, and then you look at the World's Fair, and what did that do for Chicago, and how did it change the city for Chicago? Well, those ideas for me started to play in my head. And so Christopher and I talked at length about what does a story about a working class girl and her family look like today? You know, it's not, and one thing that always bothered me about the Nutcracker is it's set in Europe. It's about a very wealthy family, kids that have every gift they could ever want in the world. Well, that isn't the reality. The reality is that we all have amazing imagination, even if we don't have wealth. And so how do we then take a simple party scene of workers gathering to celebrate the holidays and that Marie, this young girl, has the ability to dream way beyond her situation? Mm-hmm. And so I think that it allows you access to many people because we identify with the characters that are in the ballet. And I think also that, you know, the World's Fair was, in many ways, it allows us to rethink the second act of Nutcracker, because in most productions, the act one is very exciting and act two is very much about the dancing. But what happened right to the story? So now we can go, the World's Fair was Pavilions of the World. So the second act of Nutcracker is the world. It's like a trip around the world.
Chicago audiences are familiar with Broadway caliber talent coming through. A lot of it is at Broadway in Chicago, and you're going to have right around the corner from you guys just this concept of, you know, a touring show, a Broadway show, maybe a show that already was successful, or we have the other on the other side, this concept of coming here to experiment, to try things, and then move on to Broadway or to others. For this, I mean, is there a future after Joffrey Ballet with the Nutcracker? I mean, with you're using Broadway talent, is this essentially an audition, or is this just for the Joffrey
this
Ballet?
This is just for the Joffrey. Wow. And we have a long license on the production, because for the Joffrey Ballet, like for every major company, their Nutcracker is a really important work from many different points of view. For a lot of young kids, it's their first kind of access into theater. So, you know, we have hundreds of kids in the Nutcracker. They either, you know, grow up loving ballet or loving dance. They become our audience. They become the next young, brilliant talent, whether they're going to be a classical ballet dancer or a hip-hop artist. And also for our audience, it's a gateway for them to access dance and the Joffrey. So I think that it serves many, many purposes. And I think that if we're going to continue to do the Nutcracker, how do we engage everyone at every level? Mm-hmm. How do we engage grandparents? How do we engage men and boys? And, you know, that it's not just about kids.
You know, this production, obviously, we're talking about this in April. I mean, this production is for December. How far out do you start rehearsals and start working on the script? And you know, even though you announced the creative team today, what does that mean?
Well, we have been wanting to kind of announce it for the last year, but you need to get everything in the right place at the right time. But for people to know that Christopher and I had a conversation back in 2007 about...
That gives you an idea.
You know, Christopher, he wanted to do a new Nutcracker, and he really wanted... I had just been appointed the director of the Joffrey. He wanted to do it for the Joffrey. That, from someone like Christopher Wheeldon, is a huge trust to say, yeah. Well, you know, what is the company going to be like under my direction? Where are we going to go? And it's just been an amazing journey. And I think then to have Brian Selznick come in to rewrite what the Nutcracker would look like, it has all taken quite a few years.
And what is it? So when you get the actors on stage, the dancers on stage, when does that process?
So we finish our season at the end of May. And then the dancers have a layoff period. We start back in July. So Christopher will work with us July, August, September. We then have Romeo and Juliet in the fall, which is of a totally different idea. Mm-hmm. And then the minute Romeo and Juliet closes, we will be back into the Nutcracker because we will then go into tech rehearsal. They will tech the scenic elements because it's quite complicated. And then we will put, once that's all running smoothly, you then put the company with everything else. And actually, some of the last things to really happen, even though Natasha Katz has been planning the lighting, you know, she doesn't get to it physically
until a couple of weeks before we open.
And the same with 59 Projections and Ben Piercy. They have ideas and they work on those ideas. But until you fit it all in with the scenic element and who and where we are on the stage. So, you know, it is for Christopher, it is not only choreographing, but really directing the whole idea. Like, what is the journey that we want to take our audience on? And where do we want at the end of it for them to be?
Well, we're looking forward to it, and we got to continue. We should have you back this summer to see how the rehearsals went. And as we get ready for the new Nutcracker, which will be put on by choreographer Christopher Wheeldon. Ashley Weider is the artistic director of the Joffrey Ballet. He joined me today. Congrats on the announcement of the big team that is going to be working on the Nutcracker.
Thank you very much, Justin.
Coming up, Patty Vasquez. Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez, starting at 11 o'clock. We're on the air tomorrow night to download. Wednesday night, of course, Blackhawks playoff, Stanley Cup playoffs against St. Louis Blues. Awesome. We're back on Thursday. And then game two will be Friday night here on WGN. Next week, just a programming note, with the Blackhawks playoff schedule and spring break, we will be out. So Amy Goose will be doing one of the shows. I'm not sure who's doing the others, but it's in between the playoff schedule of next week. We'll be back on whatever that next Monday is. Coming up this week, though, we got some unbelievable guests coming up. Tomorrow, John Weideman's going to join us at the big table, which is great. The play-by-play announcer for the Chicago Blackhawks here on 720 WGN. Just what I want to talk to him about more than anything is just how in the heck can you keep up that fast with radio hockey?
Yeah.
It's amazing to me. You listen to John, he's like, up to da da ba da ba da ba da ba da ba da 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 da. Like, I'm just like...
Exactly like that.
Yeah, exactly like that. But I'm excited to talk to him about that because there's an art and a skill and a philosophy and a strategy that goes into doing play-by-play hockey. Hockey is different than basketball. It's different than baseball and football. All those things have their own, you know, little issues, you know, as an announcer. But hockey is nonstop. I mean, it's like a fluid game. Baseball, you could pretty much fall asleep, take a nap. Ball two. Football has, you know, a lot of action, but there's 45 seconds between each play. Or, you know, like you get the
yeah,
you
there's know, time.
Get, yeah, there's a lot of time to go down to the sideline and see who's hurt. Basketball's the same way. You know, it's a fast-paced game, but there's that they've learned to slow it down. There's that bringing the ball up the court takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they play 16 different Nelly songs at the stadium, you know, to kind of get it up and down. So we'll talk to John Weideman tomorrow on the program. He'll be
awesome.
On the big table. Also tomorrow, which I'm so excited about, the premiere of the SimFest, the Chicago International Music and Movies Festival, is starting this week.
Yeah.
And the opening night, the Smart Studios story, it's a documentary about the Smart Studios in Madison, Wisconsin. And our guest tomorrow night on the show, legendary music producer Butch Vig.
Wow.
How great is that? And I know a lot of people at WGN Radio are like, all right, here comes another one of those alt people that no one's ever heard of. Yeah, they've done the Bongles. He produced the Bongles. They're great. You don't know the Bongles? No. This guy produced Nevermind, Nirvana's record.
You may have heard of it.
You may have heard of it. I love when I was looking at the research for it. It's diamond selling. Like, I've never seen anything at, like, diamond level. So there's platinum, gold, all that kind of thing. It's diamond.
50 million?
I don't know what that is. Yeah. The Smashing Pumpkins, both Gish and Siamese Dream was Butch Vig. Sonic Youth, Dirty. Down the line, the bands that have come through that studio, it's just an enormous amount of bands from the 90s and 2000s. Obviously, he's the drummer and producer for the band Garbage. They got a new record coming out. So we'll talk with Butch Vig about the documentary, about his life in music, about producing albums.
So cool.
So cool. Also this week, Rebecca Drysdale. Rebecca Drysdale is a former writer from Key & Peele, and she moved over to produce and write for Baskets, show that just wrapped up with Zach Galifianakis. So we'll talk to her. Chicagoan who had a great show here with Jordan Peele from Key & Peele when they were doing improv and they were coming up here in Chicago. So we'll talk with her. Also, Scott Armstrong, who's from Chicago, who is the creator, director, writer of the show Dice.
Oh, yeah.
On Showtime, which premiered Sunday night that I got nothing but good reviews off of. This is the sort of fictional What Happened to Andrew Dice Clay scripted comedy. Scott Armstrong's the writer. He grew up in Wheaton, and he spent time here in Chicago, so he is in L.A. now, but he's going to join us, and we'll talk about
Sweet.
The show. So we got a lot of great stuff.
That's
a lot of great stuff.
That's stacked for
the two shows we have.
For the two full shows.
We got to shove all that stuff. We have to get all that. We just, like, shoehorn. I'm dealing with people. I got the phone on one. And just, hey, can you do Tuesday? Can you do Thursday? Like, we're getting it done, so... all that coming up on the download this week.